each episode, I'll be uncovering the stories behind these different materials of state and asking how they speak to the past, present and future of British political history.
They're always going to be sources of discussion, debate and disagreement.
Materials of State begins on Monday afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 21st of November. Good morning. This is Today with Anna Foster in Salford, Justin Webb in London.
Good morning. The headlines today. Sir Keir Starmer says ministers are looking very carefully at the latest report by the COVID inquiry and are taking measures to ensure they're prepared for any future pandemic. We will speak to Michael Gove, who was minister for the Cabinet Office for much of the pandemic, later in the programme. And President Zelensky has given a guarded response to a plan drafted by the Trump administration for ending the war in Ukraine, insisting his country needs a dignified peace.
And also in the programme, Debbie Duncan, the mother of Jay Slater, the teenager who died in Tenerife last year, tells us why she wants a law to stop online abuse aimed at grieving families.
My phone never stopped at the beginning, like prank calls, you know, there were videos put up, they were changing the voices, and oh, it was just one thing after another. But you were going down rabbit holes yourself because they were convincing.
And the story of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe is going to be told in a new BBC drama this week. We'll be talking to her husband, Richard Ratcliffe, and the man playing him, Joseph Fiennes. The BBC News is read this morning by Vijay Ellis.
Sir Keir Starmer says the government is looking very carefully at the latest report by the COVID inquiry, which assessed the political response to the pandemic. It concluded that there would have been 23,000 fewer deaths in England had the lockdown been introduced earlier. It also found that the UK's four governments had consistently failed to take swift and decisive action. Here's our political correspondent Helen Catt.
The Prime Minister said the government was taking measures to make sure that it was prepared for any number of eventualities, although he had earlier warned that public services, including the NHS, had still not recovered from the pandemic. The Liberal Democrats said an apology was required and called on Kemi Badenoch to say sorry for the failings found in Boris Johnson's government. Mr Johnson has not commented on the inquiry's findings, neither have Rishi Sunak or Matt Hancock, who also faced criticism. Dominic Cummings, formerly the most senior aide at Number 10, was described as becoming a destabilising influence. He accused the inquiry of rewriting history.
The White House has confirmed that President Trump has given his backing to a new plan to negotiate an end to the war in Ukraine. Unconfirmed reports suggest that a 28-point proposal includes many of Moscow's long-standing demands. Ukraine's President Zelensky has pledged to try to make the U.S. proposals work. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman reports from Washington.
The White House spokeswoman Caroline Levitt confirmed that US officials have drawn up a new plan to end the war and that President Trump supported it. She said it had been worked on quietly over the last month by Mr. Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff and the Secretary of State Marco Rubio. She wouldn't confirm its contents, which are widely reported to be heavily tilted towards Moscow. Pressed on this, Ms. Levitt said the US was hearing out both sides to come to an agreeable outcome. She earlier said Mr. Trump had become increasingly frustrated with both Russia and Ukraine over what she called their refusal to commit to a peace agreement.
The energy regulator Ofgem will announce its new price cap in the next hour, affecting millions of bill payers in England, Scotland and Wales. Analysts have predicted the quarterly cap is likely to fall slightly ahead of a rise in the spring. Here's our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey.
Ofgem's next price cap comes into effect at the start of January, at the height of winter. It sets the maximum price for each unit of energy, not the total bill, so using more means consumers pay more. Analysts at the consultancy Cornwall Insight have predicted a 1% fall in prices compared with the current cap, but they also expect the cap to go back up again in April. Charities say they're seeing people owing increasing levels of unpaid bills and charges to suppliers, but the government has hinted at extra cost-of-living support in next week's budget.
The National Crime Agency has revealed that a money laundering network operating in the UK bought a bank to help Russia evade Western sanctions and channel funds towards its war machine. The NCA said the group had used hundreds of couriers across British towns and cities to collect cash earned from drug dealing and firearms trafficking. Investigators warned that someone buying cocaine in the UK could be indirectly helping Russian arms factories. Sal Melki is from the NCA.
Something as innocuous or as innocuous as it feels as buying a small amount of cocaine on a Friday night has real consequences. So the National Crime Agency can look at that payment and follow that payment. And as we zoom out, we can see that money being converted into cryptocurrency, and we can see the beneficiaries of that trade, including the money laundering groups in this instance, generate huge sums of money that has enabled them to purchase a bank.
An unnamed Strictly Come Dancing star has been arrested on suspicion of rape. According to The Sun, the man is alleged to have attacked a woman after a BBC event. He was arrested last month and has since been released on police bail. The BBC said it wasn't appropriate to comment on an ongoing police investigation. A report has found that nearly a third of councils and NHS trusts in the UK are paying hourly rates for home care that fail to cover the cost of a full-time worker at minimum wage. The Home Care Association says the situation is unsustainable. The Department of Health says it's boosting funding for the sector by £4 billion. Here's our social affairs editor, Alison Holt.
Using Freedom of Information requests, the Home Care Association has gathered information from 275 out of the 276 councils and NHS organisations that pay for the social care which supports people at home. It found on average UK care providers were paid £24.36 an hour, nearly £10 below the amount the association says is needed to cover all costs and allow businesses to make a small profit. It also found 29% of the organisations didn't pay enough to meet the basic cost of employing a care worker on the minimum wage.
A major prostate cancer screening trial has begun, which aims to find the best way to detect the disease. Invites will initially be sent out to 16,000 men across the UK, but this will eventually be expanded to up to 300,000. The trial will look at how rapid MRI scans combined with blood or saliva spit tests could improve the accuracy of diagnosis. A charity building a replica of the world-famous Sutton Hoo burial ship is asking members of the public to suggest names for the vessel. The ship is believed to have been a burial chamber for an Anglo-Saxon king and lay undiscovered for centuries in the Suffolk countryside until it was discovered in 1939. It's hoped the replica will launch in 2027. The project manager, Jacques Bernard, says its name should be symbolic.
It's got to be something to do with the history of this ship or the local area or Anglo-Saxon history. We're obviously going to avoid the boating with boatface. We're not going down that route, so we need to keep enough control over it to make sure that the name is fitting for something as kind of as amazing as this.
That was Jacques Bernard.
Thank you, Vijay. It's 7 minutes past six now. It is cold. Very cold, but you want a little more detail than that, don't you? Sarah Keith Lucas is here too. Tell us more. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Anna. Yes, certainly cold. In fact, it has been the coldest night of the season so far. We've had temperatures at minus 11 in Highland Scotland. Quite widely, though, well below freezing for many of us this morning. So a sharp frost and some icy stretches to watch out for, particularly close to coastal areas where we've had recent wintry showers. Now, this morning across England and Wales, we've still got a few showers. They're falling as rain and sleet. For the far southeast, so Kent, parts of Suffolk, for instance, around East Anglia, just a few showers. Also the far west, so Pembrokeshire down towards Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly. Now, most of these showers will ease away over the next few hours, so mostly dry for England and Wales today. Lots of blue sky and sunshine, areas of cloud drifting around, particularly towards the east, and temperatures this afternoon around 5 to 8 degrees, so a touch milder than it has been over the past couple of days. For Scotland and for Northern Ireland, bitterly cold to start, but this morning looks largely dry. There'll be some sunshine, particularly for central and eastern parts of Scotland. The cloud already building across Northern Ireland, and we'll continue to see things clouding over through today as a weather front moves in from the northwest. That'll bring some rain gradually in from the northwest later this afternoon into this evening, and it'll be preceded by a little bit more snow for the Grampians, the Cairngorms, for instance, as well. But at low levels, it'll be falling as rain. Temperatures here around 2 to 5 degrees. And then through tonight, that band of cloud and rain sinks its way southwards and eastwards across the UK. It won't be as cold as recent nights, with temperatures a few degrees either side of freezing. But into the weekend, then, it is looking unsettled. Rain at times on Saturday, followed by heavy showers, windy conditions on Sunday, but those temperatures will be on the rise.
Sarah, thank you for that. 9 minutes past six is the time. Let us have our first look at the papers. Many of the front pages focusing on the latest report from the COVID inquiry. Toxic, chaotic, calamitous are the three words chosen by the Metro. As it notes that while Boris Johnson was castigated, all of the UK's governments were found to have done too little too late. The Daily Mirror says the former Prime Minister's handling of the crisis was inexcusable, as it highlights the finding that he repeated mistakes. The Guardian says the report puts pay to any delusions that he had the qualities necessary to be Prime Minister, let alone one guiding the country through a deadly national emergency. The I paper says any ambitions of a return to political life are now delusional. The Daily Star calls Mr Johnson the killer clown. The Sun describes the verdict as predictable but damning and says the state must ensure that the mistakes are not repeated in any future public health crisis.
But some of the front page analysis this morning takes a different approach. In its editorial, the Daily Mail, for whom, of course, Boris Johnson now writes a column, argues that, of course, things would have been done better had the politicians involved known then what they know now. But how could they? The Daily Telegraph says the costliest inquiry in British history tells us what we already know, that lockdown was not necessary. It quotes the cancer specialist and lockdown sceptic, Professor Carol Sikora, as saying the report has no scientific credibility at all. All just lots of pretty ignorant lawyers and ex-politicians milking the system for fame, fortune and glory. It's amazing what £200 million worth of hindsight can buy you, suggests the Times sketchwriter Tom Peck.
Many of the papers pay tribute to the Stone Roses and Primal Scream bassist Gary Mounfield, known as Manny, who died at the age of 63. The Guardian's music critic, Alice Petredis, says Manny's funky bass taught indie kids how to dance. The Mirror says he was the soul of the Stone Roses. For the Times, he was the beating heart of the band, nodding to one of the band's biggest hits. The Sun says, you were adored, Manny.
It is 11 minutes past six now. Today is supposed to be the final day of COP30 in Brazil, but the negotiations are still underway. Not unusual for that to be happening on the final day, but last night it wasn't the ongoing conversation over fossil fuels that was making headlines. Instead, it was a fire that started inside the conference centre. Our climate and science reporter Esme Stallard is there. Esme, before we talk about this final day of negotiations, what happened yesterday evening?
Yeah, so when diplomats should have been inside the negotiating rooms, they were huddled outside in the rain. That's because around 2 p.m. local time, a fire broke out in one of the pavilions. In the giant conference centre, there's dozens of these pavilions that countries host talks at, and a fire started at one of them, and the flames grew very quickly. So the conference centre is like a big top tent, effectively. It's very hot inside, and the flames reached the roof some 20 foot high, and immediately everyone started to be evacuated. It was quite dramatic, with lots of people running around. We understand that no one was injured, but 13 people were treated for smoke inhalation. Now, of course, this is not a good look for the Brazilians. You might remember that the conference centre was evacuated just last week after protesters stormed it, and it's come at probably the worst time. You know, countries are right in the midst of negotiations, and they were trying to get a new draft text out last night. We saw EU representatives actually outside in the rain huddle trying to carry on those negotiations, and they've had to resume much later in the evening, so that's delayed things even further.
Yeah, and what is it, Esme, that they're hoping to agree on, first of all, and what are the chances of them managing it?
So they're talking on quite a few areas. They're looking at trying to agree indicators to measure adaptation goal. They're looking at financing. But the key thing that's making them very much loggerheads is this new roadmap on fossil fuels that President Lula is trying to get across. 80 countries, we understand, including the UK, support further detail on trying to move away from fossil fuels. That first commitment to transitioning away was done a couple of years ago back in Dubai. But we understand that many major oil producers, including Saudi Arabia, Russia, Nigeria, have rejected that, and it's not in the latest text. We were meant to see that last night. We haven't. We're expecting that sometime this morning. But it shows, you know, as with most COPs, it's going to probably go right to the wire.
Esme Stallard in Brazil, thank you for joining us.
30 minutes past six. What is the best way to detect a prostate cancer? We are about to find out. It seems Fergus Walsh, our medical editor, is on the line. It's a big trial, this one, isn't it, Fergus? Tell us about it.
Yeah, it is. The TRANSFORM trial, £42 million study funded by Prostate Cancer UK and the National Institute for Health and Care Research. It's going to look at ways of scanning for the disease. Rapid MRI scans have come to the fore in recent years. It'll also compare and combine these with traditional blood tests, which measure for levels of a protein called PSA, and saliva spit tests, which look for genetic markers. Initially, 16,000 men across the UK will be recruited. That'll be eventually expanded to up to 300,000. They'll be aged 50 to 74, but there'll be a lower age limit of 45 for black men who have twice the risk of developing and dying from prostate cancer than white men.
Mm. Does this bring to an end, will it bring to an end, the debate that there has been about the value of a national screening programme?
Yes, it should do. Coincidentally, the National Screening Committee, an expert body which advises the NHS, is due to meet and decide next week whether to recommend if there should be a prostate cancer screening programme based on the current evidence. Now, previously, the committee has said that the harms of screening outweigh the benefits. You know, this is the most common cancer in men in the UK. Men over 50 can request a PSA blood test. And studies have shown it does save lives, but it also causes a lot of harm. The PSA picks up a lot of cancers that would never cause problems, and it misses others that would. Now, treatment has improved, but it can lead to urinary incontinence and impotence. So the point of this trial is to find out and lay the groundwork for establishing a screening programme.
Fergus Walsh, thank you.
It's 6:15 now. The pensions industry is warning the government not to change the rules around salary sacrifice schemes in the budget next week. Will has more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Anna. Morning, Justin. Yes, one of the many runners and riders, it seems, for potential budget changes is to try and raise some of that money towards the estimated £20 billion black hole in the public finances is apparently to change some of the salary sacrifice benefits for pensions by, according to many reports across a number of the papers, that the government would cap the amount someone could put into a pension before both they and their employer started paying national insurance at £2,000 a year. At the moment, employees can currently put up to £60,000 a year tax-free into pensions. Benoit Oudon is with us. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the financial services consulting firm Mercer UK. Benoit, morning.
Good morning.
What kind of impact would that have, do you think, then, changing that cap down from 60 to 2,000 a year?
It would have impact in the short term as well as in the long term. Let's focus on the short term for a second. On the one hand, we know people in the UK already aren't saving enough for retirement, so that would bring a further reduction in savings. At the same time, many employers would face yet another increase in national insurance costs, which they're likely to want to cover by giving either lower salary increases to their employees, potential cutback in pension benefits, or even potentially create less jobs in the UK, all of which would negatively impact the economy.
Right, to try and stay under that new cap, should one exist, because once you went over it, you start, just explain that through, both the employee and the employer would start paying national insurance beyond that 2,000 if that was indeed the cap.
That is absolutely the case. So the portion currently you sacrifice via a pension salary sacrifice arrangement, you've said at the beginning, you can do that up to £60,000 currently, which means on those amounts you sacrifice, you don't pay national insurance, both the employees and the employer. If that cap is reduced, you start paying national insurance at a much lower threshold.
Whilst the cap rate, you know, that is a big gap, isn't it, between 60 and 2, clearly someone who is managing to put in 60,000 a year is earning a significant salary. Is it that a cap could come in somewhere in between the two? Do you think that would make sense in terms of raising revenue? I mean, the government's talking about this potentially raising £4 billion, some of this changes, or so the reports suggesting that it might be a runner on rider, suggesting that's how much money it could make. Do you think a cap somewhere in between the two numbers could make sense?
Well, there's many considerations on your comment about the 60 and affordability. Obviously, in isolation, someone who can afford to put $60,000 to their pension every year has to have certain means. But there are other considerations as well. That means, it could or could not mean that the individual has a certain way of living. The putting a cap in between is a possibility. It's speculation at this point where they may land. But anything, maybe the way I would answer that question is, right now, we know it is estimated already that by 2050, there will be a savings gap in the UK of 25 trillion pounds. That is a projection that's been done by the World Economic Forum. So many future retirees will not have enough money to live on. All this while the UK population is aging rapidly, which puts tremendous pressure on the NHS. And if we think the NHS is expensive today, wait a few years when costs increase tens of billions of pounds more every year because the population requires more care. So anything that reduces the amount of savings people put aside in the, you know, will have consequences in the longer term.
Benoit Houdon, Chief Exec at Mercy UK. Thanks so much for your time this morning. Well, Colleen McHugh is also with us, investment consultant to the investment firm Wealthify. Colleen, morning.
Good morning,
Will. It's been the story of not just this week, but the last few weeks, hasn't it, about AI, investments, whether it's a bubble or not. Nick talking yesterday to Eileen Burbidge about NVIDIA's results seem to have calmed markets. And then overnight in the United States, big fall, particularly on the tech-heavy NASDAQ. Was that these concerns again about the amount of money these companies are spending on AI or something else going on as well?
No, I'm afraid it's just as you say, Will. So we had NVIDIA's results on Wednesday, which were stellar. The market reacted really positively on the open on yesterday. And then as the trading session progressed, we just went further into the red. And, you know, if I look at where the NASDAQ is now, you know, it's off 7% for the month of November. So it's been a bad month. It hasn't been as low since March. And we're still not getting away from this concern about, as you say, this AI bubble.
And still, in the financial results of all of those big companies, talking about not just the amount of money they're going to spend, but also now the amount of debt they're going to take on to spend in AI, selling their own bonds. Talk lots, don't we, on the programme about government bonds, but companies now selling bonds as well, that the level of debt that they're taking on to make these investments.
They are taking on some debt, but it should be said that in terms of the cash flows that they're generating, they're still very strong. But it is an additional red flag that's been raised around these particular AI stocks. The debt that they are taking on perhaps worries about their valuations. Are they looking at, you know, are they depreciating these chips in the proper manner? But the real issue here, Will, is the sheer the fear of the concentration. I mean, these seven stocks, these Mag 7 stocks, they're making up about 33% of the S&P 500. And when the momentum's going in your favor, that's great. Yeah. But when the momentum is going down, as we've seen over the last sort of week plus, that's when people get a little bit nervous. And that's exactly what you're seeing right now.
Colleen McHugh of Wealthify, thanks so much for your time this morning. Well, the company that runs the Channel Tunnel has warned it will freeze all of its investments in the UK, claiming unsustainable levels of taxation has made any future investments non-viable. Eurotunnel says its business rates would increase by some 200% from next year as a result of new calculations by the valuation office agency. Jan Lariche, the chief executive of Eurotunnel, has been speaking to us here on the programme. We started by asking him to explain just quite what the issue was here.
We are very ambitious about the UK. There is a great opportunity to invest in the future of international rail, both for passengers and for freight. I will give you just one example. Today, there is on average 8,000 trucks crossing the channel. Those trucks are on the road in the Kent, and most of them go to London. There is a major opportunity to put many of them on rail. Today, we face a huge increase in our business rates, which is almost threefold. All our investment, all our plan are becoming unsustainable.
Explain that out then. What is your rate going from and to? And can you give us kind of a rough sense of what that will cost you?
It's very simple. Today we pay £22 million per year. And with the discussion that we are currently having with the VOA, so the agency which is making those math, those calculations, we are getting to £65 million in the future. For us, it's very hard to understand because, as you know, business rates, it's a property tax. And our property, the Channel Tunnel, has not changed. You know, it's still the same tunnel, the same terminal, the same trains, everything is equal. And so to face such an increase multiplied by three, and also to get an increase which is unpredictable, is a real issue for us because we know that in rail, we invest on the long term.
So the VOA, in their statement that they've given us, say that they've been talking to you about this over the past 18 months. You're saying that it just hasn't been clear, the amount through that process, or why?
The process is opaque. You know, in 2023, we already had a 48% increase. We are still asking for the reason, you know, for the math that are behind that increase. And this is an issue, as mentioned, because when you invest in the very long term, every 3 years, you cannot have a bad surprise. So this is really at the core of our issue. And we are asking for predictable and fair amount of taxation. If we take, for example, our Le Shuttle services, transporting cars and trucks across the channel, we are in direct competition with the ports. And the ports are benefiting from a specific scheme. And that scheme is, for them, giving predictability because it's calculated as a percentage of their revenue. We are asking just for something comparable. We want a level playing field, nothing more.
So actually, you and Gatwick Airport both kind of saying that same thing. Expand that scheme, really, or a scheme like it.
Yeah, if it's possible for the ports, you know, we don't understand why it wouldn't be possible for us. And interestingly, in some regulation, we are considered as a dry port. Our terminal already offers the same kind of service, so why not having the same kind of taxation regime?
And it means you're making decisions right now, today.
Yeah, all the investment that we had planned to do, okay, especially for freight, but also for passengers, the new ones are becoming unsustainable. That means that today we are reaching a level of marginal taxation between the business rates and corporation tax at 75%. All our new investments will be loss-making. So we will not generate the project, the growth, the employment that we had planned because of that taxation, which is much, much too high at 75%.
And that's important in two streams, isn't it? The government here in the UK in particular have been interested in reopening that Barking Centre for freight and getting more freight between Central Europe and the UK, but also for passengers. Virgin Group, for example, talking about using the Channel Tunnel, others being interested about more passenger rail going through the tunnel. What does a financial situation like the one you've described mean for the future of those kind of projects and the ability for you to go forward with any of that?
So two different situations. For freight, we are freezing all our investments. For example, Barking, we've been discussing for many months with Network Rail. We are about to sign an agreement to reopen the multimodal terminal. We are not going to do that until the day we have certainty about the fairness and predictability of our taxation. Regarding high-speed rail, as per the tunnel regulation, we pass to railway undertakings half of the business rate that we pay. So we are adding tens of millions of additional taxes on those operators. I cannot talk on their behalf, so they will make their own choice. But what I can tell you is that adding tens of millions of pounds of cost on their businesses will not be positive, and it will, of course, have consequences. It will slow down their investment the same way it will have an impact on ours.
Yes, Jan Lariche there, the chief executive of Eurotunnel on the Treasury, said to us, Justin, it doesn't comment on speculation around tax policy, but once it's understood the complete revaluation picture, it would be in a position to make final decisions on support.
Thank you for that, Will. 27 minutes past six. To the sport, here is Jonathan Ledger.
Good morning. Where do we start? Well, I can tell you the Ashes are underway, and that started well for England because they won the toss and they decided to bat. And then the cricket started.
Stark again, tall, black-haired, into his stride now. Left arm over the wicket, bowls to Crawley, who's caught? Driving. England are 0-1. Caught at first slip.
That was good, wasn't it? That was the first over. And it only got worse for England, because they were shot out just a few moments ago for 172. Let's go live to a sold-out Perth stadium where Henry Moran can bring us all the details.
Well, the only good news is that Australia are also 0-1, with Jofra Archer having struck second ball to remove the debutant Jake Weatherald. But England 172 all out in 32.5 overs. It is the second shortest Ashes innings for an England men's side, and it is a hugely disappointing return from a side, as you say, who won the toss, elected to have a bat first. But Mitchell Stark outstanding in the absence of Pat Cummins and Josh Hazlewood, taking 7 for 58, his best test figures. The only bright spot for England with the bat, Harry Brooks' half century.
So is this all about Mitchell Stark and some very good Australian bowling, or, let's quote Michael Vaughan, shall we, Bazball without brains?
I think there has to be a degree of culpability laid at the door of England's batting, the way that they chased after the short ball on these big boundaries to be caught consistently in the deep is a familiar story. The frustration will be the question marks around the warm-up, the preparation. England playing one intra-squad match as their warm-up here in Australia, and it just doesn't look like they've had enough time out in the middle. 172 all out is a poor return, having won that toss and elected to bat.
Thank you, Henry. Good luck. Watch it through your hands. Test Match Special continues on BBC Sounds. What a start. We knew it was going to be dramatic, but not that dramatic, surely. Anyway, elsewhere, championship leader in Formula One, Lando Norris, fastest in second practice for the Las Vegas Grand Prix. It finished a short time ago, the session interrupted and then curtailed by a loose manhole cover. The McLaren driver finishing just ahead of the Mercedes driver, Kimi Antonelli, with Ferrari's Charles Leclerc third. Meanwhile, the Mercedes boss, Toto Wolff, has sold 15% of his shareholding in the team. That'll net him a cool £230 million, but he's going to stay on as team principal and CEO. And one other line, in the Women's Champions League last night, Chelsea drew with Barcelona 1-1 at Stamford Bridge. It's a result that ensured that both sides maintained their unbeaten records in the league phase of the competition. And just to say, there hasn't been a wicket yet in the cricket.
Jonathan, thank you.
He had green hair and very bad teeth.
The rise and fall of Sex Pistols.
Join Gina Birch from the Raincoast.
I saw firsthand how their magnetism tore through British culture.
And me, Steve Lamack, as we explore one of Britain's most notorious bands.
Four members, no egos.
That shocked the nation.
They are the antithesis of humankind.
Defined punk and tore themselves apart.
The rise and fall of Sex Pistols.
Search Sex Pistols on BBC Sounds.
It is exactly 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London, Anna Foster in Salford, and Vijay Ellis with a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer says the UK needs to learn the lessons of COVID. After the public inquiry released its findings on the government response to the pandemic, it concluded that there would have been thousands of fewer deaths in England had the first lockdown in 2020 been introduced earlier. And it criticised the inaction of the UK's four governments. Sir Keir said he was looking carefully at the report. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has given a guarded response to new proposals drafted by Washington to end the war with Russia. He said Ukraine needed a true, dignified peace. Details of the plan haven't been confirmed officially, but media reports indicate it's heavily based on Russia's demands. They include Ukraine ceding more territory and drastically reducing the size of its army. The energy regulator Ofgem will announce its new price cap in the next half hour, affecting millions of bill payers in England, Scotland and Wales. Currently, a household using a typical amount of energy is paying just over £1,700 a year. Analysts have predicted the quarterly cap is likely to fall slightly ahead of a rise in the spring. The National Crime Agency has warned that buying cocaine on a Friday night in the UK could indirectly help Russian arms factories. The NCA said a money laundering network operating in Britain had bought a bank in Kyrgyzstan to evade Western sanctions on Russia and help it channel funds towards its war efforts. An unnamed Strictly Come Dancing star has been arrested on suspicion of rape. The Sun newspaper says the attack happened after a BBC event. Police said the man was arrested last month and has since been released on police bail. A major prostate cancer screening trial has begun to try to find the best way to detect the disease. Initially, 16,000 men will be invited to take part in the trial, which will look at how rapid MRI scans combined with blood or saliva spit tests could improve the accuracy of diagnosis.
Thank you for that, Fiji. 28 minutes to 7 is the time. Lessons must be learned and fundamental change implemented. That is what Baroness Hallett says in the government section of her COVID report issued yesterday. Let's talk to Jim Reid, our health correspondent. What reactions, Jim, have there been?
Well, as you said, there's been 19 recommendations made by Baroness Hallett in her report. So now politicians, the government, have to go away and look at those. Among the key recommendations, Justin, I think there's a kind of wider principle at stake here about taking account of other views, other experiences when you're making these huge decisions like lockdown, particularly on certain groups in society, vulnerable groups. So, for example, we had the SAGE group of scientific advisors in the pandemic that was heavily influential. Baroness Hallett recommends setting up a separate economic body that could perform a similar role and weigh up some of these other societal costs, also opening up the recruitment of some of these advisory bodies, making them more transparent to avoid groupthink. So it's recommendations like that. The government must now go away and respond in Parliament to these recommendations. Keir Starmer saying, expecting a full report probably before Christmas on this, and making the point that public services, including the NHS, in many cases have not recovered from the pandemic and are still under immense pressure.
And I suppose the point that critics make, and to an extent critics of the inquiry as well, is that it wasn't the pandemic that did those things. It was the reaction to the pandemic, and the inquiry perhaps could have said a bit more about that.
Yes, so there's been a heavy criticism in some of the newspapers this morning on that front, and also on the general cost of the inquiry, which is now running at about £200 million. There's a piece from David Frost, Lord Frost, the former cabinet minister under Boris Johnson, writing in The Telegraph, calling the inquiry a disgrace, a shame on those who produced it. It should be thrown aside with great force, he writes this morning. And his main criticism is there was not enough in this report to justify whether quite draconian measures like lockdown should have been used in the first place. Now, I think if you read the report, it does say that lockdowns and measures like that should be a last resort, but they had to be used in certain circumstances. And I think this is where the main criticism is now going to come, whether there's enough proper analysis in this 800-page report of whether these measures like lockdown were really needed in the first place, and whether the other side effects, in a way, of lockdown were properly taken into account.
For that, we thank you, Jim, and we'll be talking later on in the programme to Lord Gove, Michael Gove, at 8:10, who was, for a time at least, chair of the COVID-19 Operations Subcommittee of the Cabinet when he was a Cabinet Minister during it all, and also to Professor Carl Hennigan at 7:30, who was himself at the time a critic of lockdowns.
It is 7:25. The former leader of Reform UK in Wales is being sentenced today for taking bribes as part of a pro-Russian influence campaign in the European Parliament. Nathan Gill was an MEP between 2014 and 2020 and briefly sat in the Welsh Parliament. Joe Pike is our political correspondent. Morning, Joe.
Morning, Anna.
Tell us, who is Nathan Gill and why is this significant?
He was, Anna, sources say, Nigel Farage's right-hand man in the final years of British politicians being at the European Parliament, although we should make it very clear there's absolutely no suggestion Mr. Farage was aware of these crimes. Nathan Gill is softly spoken. He's a former Mormon bishop, and he moved through the parties from UKIP to the Brexit Party to Reform. What we now know is that while he was an MEP, he was accepting secret bribes in cash, totalling, the authorities think, tens of thousands of pounds. The money was coming from Oleg Voloshin, a former Ukrainian politician who the FBI have said is linked to the Russian secret services. Now, these offences were in 2018, 2019, 2020, so before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And in return for the money, the cash, Nathan Gill made speeches in Parliament. He gave interviews to a pro-Russian Ukrainian TV channel and also organised a parliamentary meeting with an ally of President Putin. Prosecutors effectively say he was a pawn in an influence and lobbying operation in Ukraine for pro-Russian interests. In terms of Oleg Voloshin, the man prosecutors say paid Gill, he's told the BBC, Nathan Gill never wittingly or unwittingly worked for Russia, and there was no political bribery related to Russian security services. Meanwhile, Mr. Farage has said he's stunned by these revelations. I didn't know anything about it, he said earlier this month. But Anna, Nathan Gill will make history today. He is the first politician to be sentenced under the UK's Bribery Act.
And what impact could this have on Reform?
Well, Mr. Farage, as we've said, has been close to Gill, even though authorities say there's zero evidence of links between Nigel Farage and this criminality. However, if we put all of that aside, this saga, this scandal, some would call it, with its links to Russia, is awkward for a leader and a party who critics have kept acclaim for a number of years, a soft on Vladimir Putin. So if we go back 10 years or so, Mr. Farage was dogged by accusations of sympathy for Putin. He said in 2014 he admired the Russian president as an operator. He's previously, of course, been criticised for appearing on RT Russia Today, that television network which is state-controlled. And in 2022, Mr. Farage tweeted, Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine was a consequence of EU and NATO expansion. It will be certainly interesting today to see how Labour and the Conservatives respond to the sentencing, because I've certainly spoken to senior Conservatives who've told me that in the coming months they plan to attack reform and Mr. Farage as weak on national security, something of course Mr. Farage would contest. Likely aware of all of this, in recent weeks Nigel Farage has been toughening up his public interventions on foreign policy and on Russia. He's argued that the UK should shoot down Russian jets if they enter NATO airspace. He's also said, Anna, Vladimir Putin is a very bad dude. The sentencing of Nathan Gill is due to start at 10:30.
Joe Pike, thank you. It is a fascinating story. If you want to know more, you can find out. There's a documentary, The Big Cases, Bribes, Lies and the British Politician, which will be available on the BBC iPlayer from this evening.
Time's just coming up to 22:07. A Strictly Come Dancing star has been arrested on suspicion of rape. Let's talk to Noor Danji, our correspondent. What do we know? What can we say about this case, Noor?
Well, so far, Justin, we don't know the name of the star in question, but according to The Sun, the man is alleged to have raped a woman after a BBC event. And the newspaper says that the woman was not a contestant or a professional dancer on the show, but had met the man due to his participation in the competition. Now, in a statement, Hertfordshire police said that the man was arrested in London on the 13th of October and has been released on police bail under investigation. And the police force said that inquiries by officers would continue. Now, the BBC wouldn't comment. A BBC spokesperson said it would not be appropriate to comment on an ongoing police investigation. But I think if we take a step back, I mean, clearly this comes at a difficult time for Strictly Come Dancing, which is, of course, one of the BBC's flagship shows. It has faced a string of controversies over the past few years, just relating to the behaviour of some of its professional dancers and also celebrity guests. And in August, another man involved with the show was also arrested on suspicion of rape. And also in August, the Met said that it was investigating allegations of drug use on the show. And more recently, Strictly has lost two of its star presenters, Claudia Winkleman, Tess Daly, both of whom have said they will be stepping down at the end of this current series. And then, of course, more broadly, listeners will be aware that it has been a tough time for the BBC, losing both of its director general and the head of news, and still facing that threat of legal action by President Trump over that panorama edit of his speech.
Noor Danji, thank you.
It's 19 minutes to seven. The newspapers this morning dominated, as you might expect, by the headlines from yesterday's COVID inquiry. But there are some other stories in there as well. The Daily Telegraph has some interesting detail about the US peace plan for Ukraine, which has been put on the table once again, particularly in terms of what Russia might get out of it. Freed from Western sanctions, says the paper, take back the majority of its frozen assets. And also, it would rejoin the G7, apparently, making it the G8 once again. So there's a lot in it for Russia, less so for Ukraine. We're going to talk to our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, about that at 7:10. Also caught my eye on the front of the Financial Times this morning. They've done an investigation into tuna, where our tuna comes from, the dark truth behind it, the paper talks about. The fact that the world's biggest tuna fleets from places like China, Taiwan, Japan, Spain, dominating global catches. But actually, the backbone of them is tens of thousands of migrant crews from Southeast Asia and Africa who are working in brutal, dehumanising conditions, which frequently meet the International Labour Organization's definition of forced labour. So a really interesting and important investigation inside the Financial Times this morning.
Just talk a little bit about what the papers are saying about COVID. There is, as you would expect, a range of opinion. The Times is pretty sure, though, about what the inquiry means, or this latest bit of the inquiry means, for Boris Johnson. He stands accused, the Times says, in an editorial, of presiding over a chaotic administration that, through its failure to grasp the gravity of the coronavirus epidemic sweeping the country in early 2020, caused delays resulting in 23,000 unnecessary deaths. No prime minister in modern times, the Times says, has faced a charge so specific in its human cost or so damning in its assessment of his flailing leadership. Any suggestion that this self-styled jester of the British political scene could return as saviour of the Conservative Party is, the Times says, laid to rest. A very different take, though, in the Daily Telegraph from Lord Frost, David Frost, who was for a time a junior minister in the Conservative government. He says, shame on you and your inquiry, Lady Hallett. You had all the resources of the state at your disposal, and yet you've told us nothing useful. One day, the work will need to be done properly. Until that point, we can safely cast aside, he says, the conclusions of the report.
It is just coming round to 16 minutes to seven now.
The Armed Forces Minister, Al Carnes, told MPs yesterday in Parliament that the UK would defend every inch of its territorial waters after a Russian spy ship directed lasers at RAF pilots. The minister condemned what he said was a dangerous and reckless attempt to stop their monitoring and said the government knew exactly what Russia was up to, as David Cornock reports.
The Russians say the Yantar is a research vessel. Most MPs call it a spy ship. The Armed Forces Minister, Al Carnes, believes it's being used to map vital undersea cables.
The UK understands that the Yantar is but one in a fleet of Russian vessels designed to threaten our critical national underwater infrastructure and pose a threat, indeed, to our economics and our way of life.
It's the second time this year the Yantar has been spotted in or near British waters. This time a Royal Navy frigate and RAF P-8 planes were involved in tracking the vessel.
A laser assessed to be originating from the port side of the Yantar was directed at British personnel operating one of our P-8s. This was a highly dangerous and reckless attempt to disrupt our monitoring.
There were no injuries or damage to the aircraft, but the minister had a message for the Kremlin.
Russia wants to operate in this veil of darkness, and sort of in the shadows. But let's just be really clear to them. We know exactly what they are doing. We know everything that they are up to. A laser pen is not going to deter us.
The Conservative Shadow Defence Secretary, James Cartledge, thought those tough words weren't being matched by actions.
The Yantar incident shows the seriousness of the threat we face, but in response, what are the government actually doing? The answer. Labour are cutting £2.6 billion from defence spending this year, surrendering sovereignty of the Chagos Islands, and following their shameful vote this week, they're putting the British Army back in the dock.
A reference there to a bill the government hopes will deal with the legacy of the Northern Ireland Troubles. Al Carnes was a Royal Marines colonel until he became an MP last year. He didn't answer James Cartledge directly, but complained that conditions were worse when the Conservatives were in government. Callum Miller for the Liberal Democrats said the Yantar incident showed the lengths President Putin would go to undermine the UK's defence.
The use of lasers in this incident was a brazen act of aggression by Russia, which endangered the lives of RAF pilots. So has the government identified those Russian officials and military personnel who gave the order to engage so that they can be held accountable and sanctioned? What assurances can the minister give that Russia understands the consequences of repeating this aggression towards the UK?
Al Carnes told him the UK would hold people and states accountable should any of its national infrastructure be threatened. For Labour's Torkil Crichton, who represents the Western Isles, the incident was close to home.
The Yantar was intercepted in the North Atlantic, which is the UK's new front line, but for my constituents it is their backyard.
He was impressed with the Navy and RAF response.
But what kind of assurance can the minister give to my constituents about preparedness and resilience to meet these kind of hybrid attacks? Because these cables don't just run across the Atlantic, they run between our islands too.
Al Carnes said the UK's best ships, personnel and maritime aircraft would continue to monitor the seas, including from RAF Lossiemouth in the constituency of the SNP's Graham Leadbitter.
In the face of this very real Russian threat, what is the risk to RAF pilots and crews from Lossiemouth? And can you tell me the specifics of any plans to work closer with European allies to ensure safety and security of our North Sea and to ensure the protection of Scotland's coast from Russian vessels?
Al Carnes told him the UK was working closely with its EU allies to ensure the UK was protected. A Conservative, Sir Bernard Jenkins, said the incident underlined what Putin and the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, had been saying.
They think they are at war with NATO and war with the United Kingdom already. And the question is not how we retaliate directly, but how we retaliate in order to put pressure on Putin and Russia, and that is by increasing our military assistance to Ukraine to tip the balance in the favour of Ukraine.
Another Conservative, Ben Obsejecty, thought the UK needed to take more drastic action. He wondered at what point would the UK be able to stop, search and detain the Yantar.
Geographically, whereabouts within our waters would the Yantar need to be in order for us to apply some maritime interdiction via the Fleet Contingency Group?
The Fleet Contingency Group is a Royal Marines unit that specialises in boarding suspect vessels. Al Carnes has never talked much about his service career, but he let slip a few details.
Being an individual who used to be in that part of the organisation, I'm sure there's lots of people that are chomping at the bit to get involved. We must adhere to the international rules of the sea.
And he reminded anyone listening that the UK was very much aware of what the Russian vessel had been up to.
That report on Yesterday in Parliament from David Cornock brings us to just coming up to 10 to 7.
Trans people could be asked whether they should be accessing single-sex services that don't match their biological sex based on their physical appearance or behaviour, according to proposed new guidance seen by the BBC. The Equalities Watchdog, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, has produced a code of practice which is awaiting government approval. But the time that that is taking is of concern to, among others, businesses who want to know how they should apply in practice the Supreme Court ruling that a woman is legally defined by biological sex for the purposes of the Equality Act. Kate Nichols is the CEO of UK Hospitality.
The leaked guidance that has come out over the last couple of days does provide some degree of certainty, but it does put a lot of onus back onto individuals, companies, businesses and site operators, because it suggests that people could be challenged about their identity. It provides the grounds for that, but we need to have some greater certainty. Businesses have been left slightly in limbo. We have a Supreme Court ruling which sets the law. We had existing guidance which was taken down. We've had interim guidance which again was taken down. And all too often hospitality businesses and employees are at the front line of having to manage these controversial issues. And we just want some clear, definitive guidance that our team members can rely upon when managing guests.
Well, Alison Holt is our social affairs editor. So, Alison, this is on the desk of the Minister for Women and Equalities, Bridget Phillipson. She says she's taking time to look at it. But as we heard there, businesses and others, they want to know now how they should be interpreting this ruling.
Yes, they do, because it is that day-to-day practicality of how they navigate, for instance, single-sex spaces. The EHRC has already said that single-sex spaces should only be open to people of the same biological sex. Otherwise, they cease to be a single-sex space. So that means, for instance, a trans woman, a biological male who identifies as a woman, would not be able to use women's toilets and changing rooms, although the proposed guidance, which I've seen a copy of, is very clear that they should, if possible, be offered alternatives. It also says where concerns are raised, for example, by a person's physical appearance or behaviour, and where practical, they can be asked to confirm their sex in a sensitive and proportionate way. It also suggests this should be done ideally in private and whilst trying to avoid potential distress to the individual. There's another interesting line which is around official documents. They say they don't provide reliable evidence of biological sex because people can self-identify on, for instance, passports and driving licenses. And with a birth certificate, if someone goes through a particular legal process, that can be changed to reflect their gender, the gender that they're living in, rather than their biological sex.
And that is what is being proposed, Alison. But in theory, this could be changed again before it becomes law, right?
Well, exactly. So the EHRC delivered its proposed guidance to the government in September. In October, they said, what's going on? We want this guidance out soon because people need it to help clarify the situation with the existing law. It could have taken 6 weeks. That was what was expected. Instead, Bridget Phillipson, the Equalities Minister, has said that she's going to take her time over this because she's emphasised the importance of getting it right. She said it was important for women to have access to single-sex provisions, such as domestic violence services and rape crisis centres, but also important that trans people should be treated with dignity and respect. And I think it's also important to say that trans people have protections from discrimination and harassment under equalities law. So a lot of this is going to be about balancing things, and the guidance that I've seen gives lots of different examples, different situations to try and help guide, for instance, hospitality in how they deal with a really complex and very controversial and sensitive and emotional area of where the law meets everyday life.
Alison Holtz, our social affairs editor, thank you.
6 minutes to seven is the time. The government is clear that legal immigration must go down. It is consulting now on more draconian rules. The General Medical Council says that might have an impact on our ability to attract foreign doctors. Professor Brian Bell is on the line, who is chair of the government's Independent Migration Advisory Committee. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What is actually being proposed, or what are we being asked to consider?
Well, actually, for doctors, very little is changing. So the government yesterday announced proposals for changes to settlement rules as to how long you have to stay in the UK before you can get what's called indefinite leave to remain. And for doctors, no change at all. They'll still be eligible after 5 years, as they have been for years and years. Same for nurses as well. So actually, for the medical profession, there's no real change proposed on the settlement side.
Does that mean that the General Medical Council has simply got this wrong?
Well, there are two things. First of all, it is true, as the GMC show, that there's been somewhat of an increase in the number of doctors from outside of the UK who are giving up their licence and leaving. I should say it's also true of UK doctors that that's happening. So I don't think it's all to do with, it's certainly nothing all to do with immigration. It's probably a lot to do with what's happening in the health service more generally. I think one area there is some concern is that the new rules, although they allow doctors, for example, to have exactly the same rules in terms of settlement, if they bring a partner with them, those partners will be subject to different rules and may take longer to get settlement. And that's a change in the sense. And that, of course, may not be an attractive option if you're bringing your partner with you.
Right. And they seem to be citing as well a sort of general overall mood swing that there has been, and that perhaps the Home Secretary is very much in charge of at the moment, that will have the impact of persuading people basically not to come, and that would be very damaging to us.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two elements to that. One is just the usual kind of the rhetoric of when people talk about immigration. You know, I've always thought it's better to try and be calm and controlled on these matters. And so I think anything we can say to make it clear that we do welcome international talent such as doctors into the UK, and we have actually a fairly liberal immigration regime for them, I think is important to emphasise. The other thing is that I think there's been there's been some uncertainty in the last few months because the government announced that they were going to make these changes in May, and now it's taken until November before we've seen the details. And so I can see why doctors and nurses may have thought, actually, we don't know what the rules are going to be. At least now, following yesterday, there's more clarity on that.
Is there a difference for nurses? Because certainly The Guardian is suggesting today that there could be, and that actually there could be quite a difference in the way that doctors and nurses are treated, and that actually a large number of nurses either won't come or might go.
Again, no, the proposals from yesterday treat nurses and doctors exactly the same. Anyone in the medical, in the health service with a graduate level job will have the same 5 years to get settlement.
Right, so it's not, the salary level in that case is irrelevant.
It's irrelevant for nurses, yeah. It's not really relevant for the private sector workers. They'll have to meet special salary thresholds, but for nurses and doctors, they're exempted from that.
Yeah.
And teachers as well.
Professor Brian Bell, that's very clear. Thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Thank
Professor
you.
Bell is chair of the government's Independent Migration Advisory Committee.
It is almost 3 minutes to seven. Tonight, Radio 4 is getting musical.
I'm Anna Phoebe.
And I'm Jeffrey Bwachi. Add to Playlist is back with a new series.
The show that seeks out obscure and often surprising links between tracks.
What, for example, links this
to this
and this
to this?
Hop on board for a serendipitous musical journey as we create a playlist of 5 tracks.
The new series of Add to Playlist.
On Friday nights at 7:15.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Weather time now. It comes this morning from Sarah Keith Lucas. Good morning.
Good morning, Justin. Thank you. It's been the coldest night of the season so far. Actually, the coldest night since January. It's down at minus 12 across parts of the Highlands of Scotland. But widely, we are starting the day below freezing, and do watch out for some icy stretches around over the next few hours, as well as that sharp frost too. Now, today will probably be the final day in this cold snap because things are then turning milder, wetter and windier into the weekend. But let's start with today's forecast across England and Wales. Whilst most places are going to be dry with some sunshine around, there are a few sharp showers this morning, particularly affecting coastal parts of Kent up towards Suffolk as well. So some thunderstorms in the mix with those really heavy showers just locally. A few showers also around the coast of Pembrokeshire, towards the Isles of Scilly and Cornwall too. But it is really around these extreme coastal areas that we're seeing some of those showers. The vast majority are looking dry, but there will be some icy stretches. Top temperatures across England and Wales ranging between about 5 to 8 degrees, not quite as chilly as recent days. Scotland and Northern Ireland then, a bitterly cold start, but a lot of dry weather this morning, some sunshine. It's going to be clouding over from the northwest as a front moves its way in. So that'll bring some rain across Scotland and Northern Ireland late this afternoon into the evening, preceded by a little bit of hill snow for the Grampians, the Cairngorm Mountains as well. But at lower levels, it'll be falling as rain. Now through tonight then, that band of cloud and rain in the northwest sinks southeastwards into England and Wales too. And that sets us up for tomorrow. They're not as cold to start the day, but there will be rain tracking southeastwards across England and Wales, followed by sunshine and showers from the northwest. The breeze will be picking up and it'll be turning milder too. And then as we head through the second half of the weekend, quite a deep area of low pressure with us for Sunday, bringing some really windy weather, especially towards the south. So by Sunday, we could see gusts in excess of 50 miles an hour for parts of southern England, Wales, perhaps Northern Ireland as well. Yes, it's turning milder, but then things remain quite showery and windy too, right through into Monday.
Thank you very much indeed, Sarah. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 21st of November. The headlines this morning. The Prime Minister says the UK has to learn the lessons of COVID after a report characterised the government's response to the pandemic as too little, too late. President Zelensky says Ukraine needs a dignified peace in response to new US proposals to end the war with Russia, which reports suggest are heavily based on Moscow's demands. And the National Crime Agency has warned that anyone buying cocaine in the UK could be indirectly funding Russian arms factories, as it reveals the operations of a major money laundering network.
Also to come on the programme this morning, Debbie Duncan, the mum of Jay Slater, the teenager who died in Tenerife last year, explains why she wants a law to stop so-called tragedy trolls.
My phone never stopped at the beginning, like prank calls, you know, there were videos put up, they were changing the voices and, oh, it was just one thing after another. But you were going down rabbit holes yourself because they were convincing.
We'll find out how identifying a new type of lion's roar could help better protect the big cats. Ooh, and England failed to roar down under.
All out. Oh, England all out. Not with a bang, baby, with a big whimper. That is terrible.
It wasn't great. More to come on that. But before all of that, the BBC News is read by VG Alice.
Sir Keir Starmer says the government is looking very carefully at the latest report by the COVID inquiry, which assessed the political response to the pandemic. It concluded that there would have been 23,000 fewer deaths in England during the first wave of the outbreak had the lockdown been introduced earlier. It also found that the UK's four governments had consistently failed to take swift and decisive action. Here's our political correspondent Helen Catt.
The Prime Minister said the government was taking measures to make sure that it was prepared for any number of eventualities, although he had earlier warned that public services, including the NHS, had still not recovered from the pandemic. The Liberal Democrats said an apology was required and called on Kemi Badenoch to say sorry for the failings found in Boris Johnson's government. Mr Johnson has not commented on the inquiry's findings. Neither have Rishi Sunak or Matt Hancock, who also faced criticism. Dominic Cummings, formerly the most senior aide at Number 10, was described as becoming a destabilising influence. He accused the inquiry of rewriting history. Mr. Johnson's former chief whip, Sir Mark Spencer, told The World Tonight that there had been divisions, but said it was because the government had been dealing with brand new things and insisted Mr. Johnson had demonstrated leadership. Lord Frost, who was made a minister by Boris Johnson, dismissed the inquiry's conclusions as easy and convenient and said they should be cast aside.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has given a guarded response to new US proposals to end the war with Russia. He said Ukraine needed a true, dignified peace. Details of the plan have not been confirmed officially, but media reports indicate it's heavily based on Russia's demands. From Kyiv, here's our defense correspondent Jonathan Beale.
President Zelensky has been careful not to criticize or reject this US draft peace deal, even though it appears to heavily reflect many of Moscow's demands. In his nightly address, Mr. Zelensky said Ukraine needed peace and would engage in diplomacy and issue no rash statements. But there is deep concern about some of the reported proposals, including giving up the entire Donbass region, reducing the size of Ukraine's military, and ruling out the presence of international troops in the country. Europe appears to have had little say over the drafting of this plan, but wants its voice heard. There may not be much time. US officials who presented the plan, approved by President Trump, are said to be working to an aggressive timetable, with the hope of reaching an agreement within weeks.
The National Crime Agency has revealed that a money laundering network operating in the UK bought a bank to help Russia evade Western sanctions and channel funds towards its war machine. The NCA said the group had used hundreds of couriers across Britain to collect cash earned from drug dealing and firearms trafficking. Our UK correspondent Daniel Sanford reports.
For years now, the National Crime Agency has been trying to undermine the work of two Russian-led money laundering networks operating in Britain. The networks exchange dirty money, made from drug deals, the supply of illegal weapons and people smuggling, for cryptocurrency. The NCA has now discovered that one of the networks, TGR, which is run by a man called George Rossi, had used a shell company to acquire a bank in Kyrgyzstan. The Keramet Bank has been helping Russian arms companies evade sanctions while they resupply the war in Ukraine. Investigators said they've been able to draw a thread between somebody buying cocaine on a Friday night in the UK all the way through to geopolitical events that are causing suffering across the world.
An unnamed Strictly Come Dancing star has been arrested on suspicion of rape. Police said the man was arrested last month and has since been released on police bail. The BBC said it wasn't appropriate to comment on an ongoing police investigation. Here's our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
According to The Sun, the man is alleged to have raped a woman after a BBC event. The newspaper says the woman was not a contestant or professional dancer on the show, but had met the man due to his participation in the competition. In a statement, Hertfordshire police said the man was arrested in London on the 13th of October on suspicion of rape and said inquiries by officers would continue. Strictly Come Dancing, which has aired since 2004 and is predominantly filmed at Elstree Studios, has faced multiple controversies in recent years relating to the behaviour of some of its professional dancers and celebrity guests. In August, another man involved with the hit BBC show was also arrested on suspicion of rape.
Sir Keir Starmer has arrived in Johannesburg in South Africa for the annual G20 summit. He will attempt to emphasise the economic benefits his attendance at such events can bring for the UK. Our political editor Chris Mason is travelling with him.
The Prime Minister's critics like to label him Never Hear Keir because of the frequency of his international trips. Taking on that jibe, Sir Keir Starmer will make a point of emphasising what he sees as the value of acting as an ambassador for British businesses abroad. It's a long way to travel to see trains built in Derby, but he'll take us to a rail depot later to do just that and announce a new agreement where the UK will provide what are described as consultancy services to South Africa's railways. Downing Street argues that Africa provides what it calls unparalleled future opportunities for UK businesses, given half of Africans are under the age of 20, and more than a quarter of the world's population will live in the continent by 2050.
Figures just released show that public sector borrowing was £17.4 billion last month. The figure was £1.8 billion less than a year earlier, but still the third highest October figure since records began in 1993. In the past few minutes, the regulator Ofgem has announced that the energy price cap in England, Wales and Scotland will rise by 0.2% from January. That means a household using a typical amount of energy will pay £1,758 a year, £3 higher than now. A major prostate cancer screening trial has begun, which aims to find the best way to detect the disease. Invites will initially be sent out to 16,000 men across the UK. Our medical editor, Fergus Walsh, reports.
Unlike breast, bowel, cervical and lung, there is no screening programme for prostate cancer. That's because the current blood test, called PSA, is deemed too unreliable, picking up many cancers that would never cause harm and missing others that do. The Transform trial will look at how rapid MRI scans combined with blood or saliva spit tests could improve the accuracy of diagnosis and pave the way for a national screening programme.
Scientists have discovered that African lions produce two different types of roar. Using artificial intelligence, the team was able to identify a new intermediary roar, which they say will be crucial for conservation efforts. Jacob Evans reports.
According to researchers at the University of Exeter, this big cat is demonstrating two different types of roar. There's the full-throated classic roar and another slightly softer one they're calling an intermediary roar. The study says this distinction is critical for improving our understanding of lion populations and monitoring individual behaviour. However, it's not entirely clear what purpose this second roar may have. Normally, spotting any nuances relied heavily on expert judgment, but was susceptible to human bias. The AI system the scientists have used not only noticed two markedly different types of roar, but also identified each lion at a 95% accuracy rate.
Jacob Evans reporting.
Thank you, Vijay. It's 9 minutes past seven now. Another US plan for Ukraine to give up its land and return for an end to the war with Russia has been presented to President Zelensky. And it puts him in a difficult position. If you remember, when I brought you the programme from Ukraine earlier this year, there is a real split in what people there want. Most of them are desperate for the fighting to stop, of course. But the idea of ceding territory and losing the people, the friends, the loved ones who live there to Russia forever is a really painful prospect. But this very much seems to be President Trump's vision for a ceasefire, and a major corruption scandal involving Ukrainian government ministers funneling millions of dollars out of the energy sector has potentially weakened the country's hand with the US. Well, our reporter went out in Kyiv yesterday and spoke to Yuri, Olena and Mikola, and they told us their thoughts on the US proposal.
What they are offering us is not very good for us. The peace plan generally is good. The two countries should be equal in the long run, and no one should give in to this. That is, the issue of resolving the war should be there, and the war should end, that's for sure. But the conditions should be clear to ordinary people that we cannot be in a state of progress when we are attacked.
This is not acceptable. Ukraine is the one who decides, not America. Of course, America helps, but this is our land and not our war. We have to defend our land, and we will be the ones who will make decisions.
You see, I really like Trump. I really like him, and I have all my hopes with Trump, because Ukraine is no longer able to generate any protest internally, because it is very corrupt.
Well, Jeremy Bowen is our international editor. Jeremy, this is another proposal which seems heavily weighted in favour of Russia. What is going on here?
Well, yeah, in fact, if you look at, among others, the Financial Times or the Telegraph this morning, you can see what purports, which is apparently a leak of the 28-point plan. And frankly, it reads as if it was dictated by the Kremlin. Clause 1 says Ukraine's sovereignty will be confirmed, and then the other 27 clauses describe all the ways in which Ukraine will lose its sovereignty. You know, apart from turning over areas that Russia hasn't captured, There is vague talk of reliable security guarantees, but a lot more detail about how the US is going to profit from it, receiving compensation for an undefined security guarantee, Clause 10, and then Clause 14 saying that $100 billion of frozen Russian assets will be invested in reconstruction. The US will get half the profits. Europe will add $100 billion, but there's nothing about any share that they will get in all of this. I mean, I think, Anna, that of course, as you said, Zelensky is in a difficult position and he's chosen his language very carefully in terms of how he responds to this, talking about the need for peace and a deal. But I think something much more tangible came out of the UN Security Council, where the Ukrainian ambassador said three points. Of course, Ukraine wants to negotiate a just end, but these are core non-negotiable positions. No recognition of temporarily occupied territories as Russian, full respect for Ukraine's sovereignty and self-defense, and a freedom to choose alliances. And those three points are not reflected in this document.
And Jeremy, Ukraine has significant European backing, but how much is that worth in the face of what the US wants?
Well, I suppose if this document, as published, is something that the UN says has to happen, and if Ukraine, backed by Europe, I cannot see how Europe could back this, because they would have to drop everything they've said about Ukraine over the last few years in terms of trying to help it with its continued defence and its continued independence, because essentially this reflects the Russian view, this document, that the only solution to all of this is for Ukraine to lose its sovereignty, to lose its independence, to no longer be an independent nation, to have great restrictions on what it does. And this is something which Putin could then take away to the Russian people and say, look what I've achieved. I have dealt with this threat to us. And then I think tangibly, the Russians would be those people who say that, you know, this would just be a pause in which the Russians can work out what they do next, maybe even another military campaign. Well, perhaps that would be a pathway to all of that. I don't see this plan as a goer, because I cannot see how the Ukrainians, despite Zelensky's current massive internal political problems, and also the support which he has had from the Europeans, and of course they'd have to put their money where their mouth is on this one in a much bigger way if the US did move out completely, if this wasn't picked up by all parties. So, I mean, I think, sum it up, the Carl Bildt, the former Prime Minister of Sweden, who was involved in the end to the Yugoslav wars, he described this on social media as this document as a collection of the shameful, the naive and the absurd.
Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, thank you.
7:15 is the time. China is going to get its mega embassy in London, it seems. That at least is what The Times is saying this morning. At the same time, as we are warned pretty constantly at the moment that China is spying on us in huge scale, doing real damage to the UK's economic prosperity and to its resilience as well. Let us talk to Chris Mason, our political editor, who is on the road with the Prime Minister at the moment, heading for the G20. Chris, we can't confirm, can we, that this embassy is definitely going to go ahead?
So here's the timeline, Justin. Morning to you. The decision hasn't been formally taken, but the prevailing wind feels clear enough from the conversations I have had, as you mentioned, as first reported in The Times, that it looks like this is going to get the thumbs up. There's been repeated delays. The deadline for decision is a few weeks away, on the 10th of December. Now, it's what's known as a quasi-judicial decision. It's on the desk of the Housing Secretary, Steve Reid. But, I mean, clearly, this isn't your standard planning application where there's fretting about how in keeping the windows are, etc., etc. This is the latest case study in the awkwardness of the London-Beijing relationship. The intelligence agencies, MI5 and MI6, have been involved. And the noises from intelligence folk is they appear broadly comfortable with this site, perhaps if there are some mitigations taken. It's the Royal Mint Court near the Tower of London. It's very near the City of London. There's all sorts of sensitive fibre optic cables that zip lots of information around near that site. So perhaps some mitigations needed there. But it would appear that the advice that the government has sought from those from expertise and intelligence is that it is okay to say yes. And so it looks like that might be happening within the coming weeks.
And that would then open the door, wouldn't it, for Keir Starmer to go to China, which apparently seems to be something that he wants to do relatively soon.
Yeah, that's been in the offing for a while. We've seen all sorts of government ministers and senior government officials head to Beijing since the general election. There's been a definite warming up of the relationship with Beijing. The Chancellor has been there. The Business Secretary, Peter Carroll, went within a couple of days of being appointed back in September. Ollie Robbins, the senior civil servant in the Foreign Office, was there a couple of weeks ago. And the expectation for a while has been the Prime Minister would like to make a trip. Looks like that could happen within the next couple of months. And then again, we'll have another flurry, if you like, of this anguish, if you like, that we hear publicly now regularly about how the UK should manage its relationship with this superpower of China of wildly different worldview. Just this week, as you were mentioning, MPs and peers and parliamentary staff being warned by MI5 of the dangers of Chinese spying. We had the collapse of that case of two men accused of spying for China, which they denied because the UK wasn't willing to put, as some would see it, a adequately robust label on describing our concerns about the threats from China. So month by month we see these case studies, and we'll see them continuing, about how this really tricky relationship that will, I think, remain tricky in the coming decades, won't it? How is that is kind of prosecuted by this government and its successors.
Chris, we'll let you get on. Thank you.
18 minutes past seven. The government borrowed more than expected in October, according to figures just released by the Office for National Statistics. Will is back with more on that. Hello again.
Hello again, Anna. Yeah, all of this, of course, important with the budget coming up on Wednesday. The data just out from the Office for National Statistics suggests that public sector net borrowing reached £17.4 billion in October 2025. That was £1.8 billion less than October last year, but well above the £15 billion many city forecasters had anticipated. James Smith is the UK economist at the bank ING. James, morning. Also, crucially, I guess, it's above what the OBR was projecting, particularly the seven-month figure through the fiscal year so far, right, for the total amount borrowed over the fiscal year.
Hi there. Sorry, Will. I lost the question there.
Sorry, James. Was just saying, putting those numbers in a bit of context, because they are not only higher than you guys in the city were expecting, but also higher than the OBR, the Office of Budget Responsibility, has forecast, and all of that important when it comes to the maths in the budget.
Yeah, that's exactly right. These figures not helpful for Rachel Reeves next week. But what we've got to remember is the fiscal rules, what's determining the scale of the tax hikes we're getting next week. That's all about what happens later this decade, what happens to borrowing, not today, but in a few years' time. And that's more contingent on the OBR's economic predictions for the next few years. And we know those economic predictions are likely to be revised down, which is why we're talking about tax rises. So today's data, not helpful, shows that the government is borrowing more than expected, but doesn't necessarily change the decisions next week.
But still also significantly borrowing to fund day-to-day activities, which is at a higher level, which is part of those fiscal rules.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the current budget deficits, so that's day-to-day spending versus tax revenues, that is sort of well over expectations as well. And that's what the fiscal rule says. By the end of this decade, the government wants to balance that day-to-day spending against what it gets in at receipts. The problem for the government is the economic outlook isn't looking so good. If the economy's not growing so quickly, if it's not as productive, it's not getting as many tax revenues as expected.
And we saw a little bit of that as well, didn't we? I know that we had retail figures come out from the ONS as well at the same time as these this morning, and that showed a fall in retail sales in October for the first time since May.
Yeah, and these retail numbers sort of do bounce around, but it sort of adds to the sense that UK economic activity is likely to slow over the next couple of months, having performed a little bit better than expected through the first half of this year. Yeah. It's a key question for next year. Can we sort of get a bit more of a recovery at a time where the government, government spending is not rising as quickly next year? Tax rises are coming through. Is the consumer going to come under more pressure?
James Smith from the bank ING, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you. 21 minutes past seven. Donald Trump meets Zoran Mandani today in the Oval Office. Zoran Mandani, the newly elected mayor of New York, who hasn't actually taken up the post yet. Here is President Trump speaking to Nora O'Donnell on the CBS programme 60 Minutes earlier in the month.
Zoran Mandani, 34-year-old Democratic socialist.
He's the prime
communist, not socialist, communist. He's far worse than a socialist.
Some people have compared him to a left-wing version of you, charismatic, breaking the old rules. What do you think about that?
Well, I think I'm a much better-looking person than him, right?
And here is Zoran Mandani speaking directly to the president during his victory speech when he was elected.
So, Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up.
So it could be quite a meeting in the Oval Office. I've been talking to Julia Manchester, who's the White House correspondent for The Hill, the political newsletter in the United States. And we started whether with this kind of meeting between a New York mayor, newly elected, and a president is normal.
You do see governors of states and mayors of larger cities meeting with presidents, yes, but not typically right after a big election. Of course, Zoran Mamdani isn't technically mayor yet. He's still mayor-elect. So this is a little unusual. It's also unusual in that we've seen President Trump really go head-to-head with this mayor politically in terms of, you know, the campaign and, you know, what he thinks, you know, should be the policies enacted in New York. So that makes it unusual.
Who asked for the meeting?
Zoran Mamdani asked for the meeting, and he is very open about that. He talks about how, you know, he's willing to reach across the aisle to the president to work on this issue of affordability. He is saying this is his top issue. New York City, obviously, arguably the most expensive city in the United States. Zoran Mamdani ran on the issue of affordability. So he said he reached out to President Trump for the meeting. President Trump confirmed that, and then they set it up.
Yeah. And from the Trump perspective, you can see, can't you, he wants Mamdani to become a national figure because he thinks it'll do the Democrats down.
He does. And that comes from, you know, this theory that Mamdani is too far to the left and that could damage or hinder Democrats, particularly ahead of the midterms in swing states or swing congressional districts where, you know, Democrats in order to win are more centrist or moderate. So he's hoping to use Mamdani to paint the Democratic Party as a broad brush. That being said, though, President Trump also needs Mamdani to an extent. Obviously, New York City is the biggest city in the United States. It's the financial center of the U.S. and also the world. So the president of the United States does need to have some sort of a relationship or working relationship with the mayor of New York City.
You wonder what other Democrats make of it, particularly the top ones who might be vying to be president in 28, obviously Mamdani not among them, he was born abroad, etc. But there is a sort of sense, isn't there, that in the party you want to be doing battle with Trump, and it's not a bad thing to be seen to be doing battle with Donald Trump, and there are only limited enough spaces in that battle.
Yeah, but I don't think Mamdani is necessarily viewing this as a battle. I think he genuinely views this, and President Trump maybe to some extent, as an opportunity to, you know, sit down and figure something out, because at the end of the day, these two do need each other because of how integral New York City is in general. But, you know, I think if you're someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, who represents Queens, the borough in New York City, and who does come from Mamdani's wing of the party, she's watching this very, very closely. She's been floated to be a potential 2028 contender. So she's paying attention to this and how he, Mamdani, plays this.
Julia Manchester, White House correspondent for The Hill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is 26 minutes past seven now. Jonathan Ledyard is here with plenty of sporting news for us this morning, Jonathan.
Just a bit. Well, only one story, actually, because if you're only just waking up, good morning, you have missed an extraordinary opening to the first Ashes test.
Woods there with his open stance. Stark runs in towards him and he swings at this. He's hit it straight up in the air. Carey's underneath it. He takes it. All out. Oh, England all out. Not with a bang, baby, with a big whimper. That is terrible. All out for 172.
Commentator Jim Maxwell in shock as England collapsed from 105 for 4 at lunch. Australia's Mitchell Starc finishing with career best figures of 7 for 52. Then England's Jofra Archer took a wicket with his second ball. Debutant Jake Weatherall gone for naught. Australia just resuming after tea, 15 for 1. They've just gone to 18 to 1. We can talk to the great Australian bowler, Glenn McGrath. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning.
How good was Mitchell Starc? How poor was England's batting?
Well, Mitchell Starc, he really had to step up for this test match, didn't he? Had his fast bowling teammates in Captain Pat Cummins and Josh Hazlewood not in the team. So he really had to stand up, and he did. He took early wickets, he bowled well, finished with best figures of 7 for 58, you said. And yeah, that's what Australia needed. And you heard Jim Maxwell there. I think it was more with the way England finished. They lost their last 5 wickets for 12 runs in about, you know, in about 3 overs or round about that. So I think the way they finished off sort of made it look worse. But this pitch is doing plenty. There's a lot in it for the fast bowlers. It's bounce, it's pace, and it's seam movement as well. So yeah, England's not out of it yet.
I was going to say, what's a good score on this pitch then?
Well, we'll wait and see. You can't really judge a pitch until both teams have batted on it. You know, I think there was a few dejected people up here in the commentary box when England were knocked over for 172, but they're a lot happier now because there's a fair bit happening. You know, the bowlers, English bowlers are bowling well, so we have to wait till Australia finish their first innings, and then I guess you'll know exactly where the game is situated and who is on top.
One other thought. England have had a lot of criticism for their lack of preparation, just one match against the England Lions. Is that a Lions? Is that counting, do you think? Is that part of the reason, or has it just been, as Michael Bourne would say, Bazball without brains?
I don't know. It's sort of the modern-day cricketers and the scheduling that that doesn't allow for more, you know, matches pre-first test to get used to those conditions. And over here in Perth, on one of the quickest, bounciest pitches in the world, their preparation was on a really slow, low wicket, so not the ideal way to prepare. But talking to Brendan McCullum, to Baz, he was happy with the preparations. Everyone had a good hit, every good bowlers had a good hit out, so they were in good nick, he thought. And we've seen here today where it's been a bit of both, really. Some poor shot selection in England's batting, and then Harry Brook taking the bowlers on and played some incredible shots. So yeah, I'm not sure where things are at the moment.
Thank you very much, Glenn McGrath will be with you on Test Match Special, 5 Live Extra or BBC Sport Online. Harry Brook, by the way, got 52 and Ollie Pope 46, currently 19 for 1. Watch this space, back in an hour. We've got Mike Williams shortly as well, so more wickets that have gone. What a morning. God,
Jonathan, thank you.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett. For most of my career, I've been on live radio, and I love it. But I've always wondered, what if we'd had more time? How much deeper does the story go?
I remember having this very sharp thought that what you do right now, this is it. This defines your life.
I'm ready to talk and ready to listen.
I'm insulted by how little the medical community has ever bothered with this.
Ready to Talk with me, Emma Barnett, is my new podcast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
The weather this morning is bitterly cold if you haven't ventured out just yet, but it should be bright by way of compensation, at least. Just the odd shower to watch out for in western and north sea coasts.
Coming up after the news bulletin, were the lockdown sceptics right?
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford. It is just after 7:30. Vicky Ellis has a summary of the news.
The regulator Ofgem has announced that the energy price cap in England, Wales and Scotland will rise by 0.2% from January. It means a household using a typical amount of energy will pay £1,758 a year, £3 higher than now. Analysts had predicted bills would fall slightly during the winter months. Sir Keir Starmer says the UK needs to learn the lessons of COVID after the public inquiry released its findings on the government response to the pandemic. It concluded that there would have been fewer deaths in England had the first lockdown in 2020 been introduced earlier, and it criticised the inaction of the UK's 4 governments. Sir Keir said he was looking carefully at the report. Figures released this morning show that public sector borrowing was £17.4 billion last month. That's £1.8 billion less than the same time last year, but still the third highest October figure since records began more than 30 years ago. The White House has confirmed that President Trump supports a new plan to negotiate an end to the war in Ukraine. President Zelensky has given a guarded response to the proposals. Unconfirmed reports suggest they include many of Moscow's long-standing demands, including Kyiv ceding territory and reducing the size of its army. An unnamed Strictly Come Dancing star has been arrested on suspicion of rape. The Sun newspaper says the attack happened after a BBC event. Police said the man was arrested last month and has since been released on police bail. A self-portrait by the Mexican artist Frida Kahlo has sold at auction in New York for more than £40 million, a record price for a painting by a female artist. The artwork, called The Dream, was painted in 1940 and shows the artist lying in bed with a skeleton resting on the canopy above.
Thank you, Viji. It is 27 minutes to 8. What on earth were we thinking when we stopped living, when we closed schools, when we closed universities, when we tied up swings in parks and arrested and fined lonely people who gathered in illegally large groups? The COVID inquiry says the indirect damage done was not properly appreciated, and Baroness Hallett, chair of the inquiry, said that in fact lockdowns might have been avoided altogether.
Had the more stringent restrictions, short of a stay-at-home lockdown announced on the 16th of March 2020, been introduced earlier, when the number of COVID-19 cases was lower, the mandatory lockdown that was subsequently imposed might have been shorter. Conceivably, it might not have been necessary at all.
Let us talk about lockdowns and their impact, and indeed whether the inquiry has properly considered them. First to Professor Carl Hennigan, who is on the line, Director of the Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine at the University of Oxford, and himself a practising GP. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Has the inquiry told us anything useful about lockdowns?
I don't think actually most people, if you look at the sort of what's going out there, is are really disappointed in the findings. Lady Hallett there said might quite a few times. That's an hypothesis. What we really needed to do to understand the causal chains of what went on, have a proper epidemiological investigation. It's just not clear to say if we had a lockdown a week earlier, 23,000 lives might have been saved based on modelling. What we need to understand is the relationship between the sort of what was already happening, people had already modified their behaviour, and indeed, what does it mean when the government restricts people's movement compared to voluntary measures, which have got about two-thirds of the response? I think the key lesson, which I'd like it to have looked in more in detail, what happens when you give the hospital system, the health system, a heart attack? You completely shut it down and we go into a panic mode. And I think that's where we should have done. These deaths, what we need is a detailed causal assessment. What did people die of? Why did they die? And what can we do differently next time?
And to make it clear, we have not had that, in your view, from the inquiry.
No, because what we've got is a judge-led inquiry. We haven't had an epidemiological sort of investigation. What we would accept is a normal route. So I'll give you one example. In terms of understanding mortality and the effects of lockdown, there's no assessment of the peer-reviewed literature. You would expect somebody to do a sort of systematic review, given they've got 200 million to go and look at this evidence and say, right, what does the evidence tell us about the effects of lockdown? And when you do that, you see that those countries that had more restrictions, more severe restrictions, didn't actually do much better than those that did less. That is one of the important lessons.
Just to be clear about the 23,000 figure, because that is going to be, well, it is the headline, and there are newspapers today saying it means that Boris Johnson can never come back as a leader of the Conservative Party. So it has political implications as well, and it attaches to him. You are saying that that figure, which is a modelled figure, we cannot know whether it is true or not.
Correct, because that model figure, not just me, even Sir Patrick Vallon said this in October 2020. He called it a projection, not a prediction. In doing so, what you're saying is we're trying to compare what happens in the country if we do nothing. That didn't happen, by the way, compared to have with these lockdown measures. We put a series of assumptions in and then we come out with a figure. We need a much more detailed causal investigation to understand what happened. There will be no doubt avoidable and preventable deaths that we can look at, but we don't have a causal chain that allows us to understand where do we intervene differently next time. I can tell you one area, we are not even prepared for this winter, let alone a pandemic. So what do we do when we get surge in number of cases of acute respiratory infections? How are we going to deal with this? Remember, we spent over $600 million on the Nightingale hospitals that were never used. Mm. We need to understand how to be flexible, how to have a health system that can respond to surges in demand and do that really well.
Professor Hennigan, thank you very much. Let's turn to Pepe de Asio, who's on the line, General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders. He was a former head of Wales High School in Rotherham. You may remember Michelle went plenty of times to that school during the course of the pandemic. Morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
The inquiry is clear that in some respects, at least, people did not at the time take into account enough the impact that these various measures, particularly lockdowns, would have on people and specifically children. That is unquestionably the case, isn't it?
Absolutely. The headline of too little, too late, I think, comes as no surprise to anyone that reflects on that period of our history. And I think there's no shortage of people who would now say that school and colleges must never close again and must open to most pupils. But as Carla's so clearly stated just a moment ago, what we're looking for really is the so what question. So what is the plan? And it's pleasing to hear that the Prime Minister is, quote, carefully considering these findings. And what head teachers would say and what teachers would want to know is some reassurance about how we are going to learn the lessons from this and what experience we can take from it.
One of the things that I really remember is we focused a lot on the time of what to do academically for children. How do we get them laptops? How do we do this? How do we do that? How do we make sure they pass exams? Can they take exams, et cetera, et cetera? We missed out the whole socialisation piece, didn't we? And that actually is turns out to be the important one, really.
Absolutely. The real lessons that I think need to be learned are the failure to do enough to aid the wider education of young people and to look back more across not just the fact we needed laptops, not just the fact that we needed software and hardware to make sure they work, but actually all the wraparound care that goes around for young people in schools and all the benefits they gain from being together in those environments.
And lessons there potentially for the government, but lessons would you say as well for the teaching unions and for individual teachers and indeed parents that actually, because there was plenty of pressure that came from outside government, wasn't there, for lockdowns and longer lockdowns and more lockdowns and that in I mean, can we say now, do you say now that was a mistake?
I think that we're all still reeling from some of the activities that took place back then. You know, there's a reason why we have the highest ever levels of severe absence in schools, which are often connected to those young people who were most disadvantaged at that time. And there's a reason why we have a million 16 to 19 year olds that are currently not in education or employment. Yeah. And we need to learn the lessons for these and also make sure that whatever plan we're putting in place now helps those recover and respond to that time in their life.
Pepe de Asio, General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders. Thank you.
20 to 8. It has begun. Cricket fans, day one of the first Ashes test saw plenty of action while you were sleeping. Well, possibly sleeping, like Mike Williams. You might have stayed up all night to watch it. Mike, at what point in play did you start to reconsider your decision to take today off work to watch the cricket?
I'm not sure I have yet, Anna, because do you know what? I mean, it has been pretty grim watching at times for England fans, many of them watching behind the sofa or between their fingers. But actually, to be honest, you still can't take your eyes off it. It is enthralling and has been since the first ball. But as ever with any live sport, I guess, it is the hope that kills you. But we have been, you know, not short on drama. 11 wickets in 45 overs. But certainly Australia's day so far, 28 for 1 currently in reply to England's 172 all out. The shortest first innings in an Ashes first test in Australia since 1902. Plenty to go at. Lots of figures making headlines. But for Australia, it's all been about Mitchell Starc, hasn't it? Just standing up in the absence of Pat Cummings and Josh Hazlewood. Career best figures for him of 7 for 58. But It's been brilliant, but I've been here. I have no regrets, as you say, taking the day off work. I'm here in my little study. I'm watching the cricket. I've got TMS on in the background. I've got my snacks. Mm-hmm. They've been the snacks have been keeping me going through the night, and we've still got a couple of hours to go. An enthralling final session has just started.
That sounds like an empty bag of snacks to me. And you sound remarkable mental clarity there, I've got to say, Mike. And as Mike was saying as well, TMS on Five Sports Extra or BBC Sports Online, should you wish to bite your nails in solidarity for the next few hours.
Oh, the healthier snacks are, of course, available. 18 minutes to 8 is the time. You would think a roar is a roar, but it is not. A study published in Ecology and Evolution uses artificial intelligence to differentiate between lions' roars, and it's something that might, in fact, matter a lot. Here are two roars. See if you can tell the difference. This is the so-called intermediary roar. And this, the full-throated. Aha. Uh-huh. Let's talk to Jonathan Crokett, who's on the line, lead author from the study at the University of Exeter. Morning to you.
Good morning.
This tells us what?
So it's kind of really important as a monitoring technique, I'd say. So lions roar within what's called a roaring bout. So this famous iconic sound that they produce actually is a part of many different vocalizations within a wider thing. So you start with moans that develop into these roars that we just heard, and then it finishes off with a series of grunts. And whenever a lion roars, it roars like that. The full-throated roar has recently been discovered to be an individually identifiable tool. So like a human fingerprint, a lion's full-throated roar is an acoustic signature. But kind of differentiating and choosing these specific types of roar, which are important for monitoring, because if you can identify lions by their roars, you could possibly use it as a tool to count them, which is a really important conservation metric. And then it's a little bit challenging. So we were basically trying to understand how do we determine these full-throated roars when there's an array of other vocalizations within this bout.
And it's the AI that helps you do it.
Exactly. So, as I said, it's kind of a really subjective process before determining what a full-throated roar was in comparison to other vocalizations. But what we can do, what we've been able to do, is use very specific features of these roars and get an AI model to basically say, I think these are full-throated roars, I think these are intermediary roars, I think these are grunts, and it spits out the ones it thinks are full-throated roars. And then what was really cool is that we then saw that the full-throated roars, which the AI predicted, meant that we could better differentiate between individual lions compared to when a human right. selects these roars.
Right, and you were hinting earlier on that the usefulness of that could be really, really something when it comes to counting and monitoring and protecting this species.
Yeah, so traditionally, if you want to try and do a population estimate survey of lions, you would use things like camera traps. So cameras that are positioned to like trees that take photos as lions go past. Bioacoustics, which is the field of research I'm in, is really emerging at the moment and has advantages that you can detect species like a lion from much further than a camera. And if you can identify a lion by its roar, you can go, oh, I've got Steve lion here. I've got Sandra lion here, and then you can use that to start to count the number of individuals in a landscape. If you do this, you can identify population trends and identify conservation hotspots, which you need to target for your underground protection services.
Mm. Jonathan Crokett, lead author of that study from the University of Exeter. Thank you.
It is 7:45. We've made a discovery that if we get Mike Williams on the programme live, good things happen for England's cricketers.
Hopefully an omen, a breakthrough for England at last. The fight back is on. Their second wicket of this Australian innings, 28-2, just moments after we last spoke. Jofra Archer with his second wicket of the match. Manus Labuschagne playing on. So Labuschagne out, Archer with the breakthrough, Labuschagne going for 9. He has walked. Usman Khawaja at the unfamiliar position of number 4 coming out to bat now. So Australia 2 down, 28-2, replying if you have just woken up to England's 172 not all out earlier. And as we said, it is enthralling, Annie. You cannot take your eyes off it. This is sport at its best.
Yeah, and you're getting close to being able to claim this as a day at work after all. So good news all round.
He's going to be claiming for the snacks now, isn't he? 14 minutes to 8 is the time. Time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Akhandade Das, who is a Vaishnav Hindu teacher and theologian.
Good morning. Maybe like me, you learned a new word this week, parasocial, Cambridge Dictionary's word of the year. The term relates to the connection that someone feels between themselves and, say, a celebrity or created character from a book or film, even an AI chatbot. Principally, parasocial relationships are one-sided, often imagined and essentially non-reciprocal. They can be positive, increasing a person's motivation and social comfort, but might lead to unhealthy attachment, obsession and disappointment. Some scholars have categorized belief in God as a form of parasocial relationship, albeit one that often confers assurance and social sensitivity. I'm sure many religious believers testify they experience a tangible reciprocation with God in prayer and in service. Even so, it is claimed that, like human and digital parasocial comparisons, the object of one's attention is either imaginary or distant and not accessible for regular interaction. Conversely, the Vedic texts suggest that it is God who undergoes the imbalance of a one-sided relationship with ourselves. The Gita relates the many ways in which God speaks to us through our insights, intelligence, intuitions, and moments of conscience. Communications we might never acknowledge. A metaphor from the Upanishads describes that within the blossoming tree of life, there are two birds, one eagerly tasting the fruit, sometimes sweet, sometimes bitter. Meanwhile, the other bird, representing the divine, patiently waits for their parasocial friend to turn to them for a proper relationship. Theologian Graham Swig highlights how many Vedic texts depict the Supreme as the form of Krishna holding a flute. The enchanting vibration of Krishna's flute, he says, is his love call, an invitation to be embraced by the heart of the divine. Personal and communal prayer is a feature of Vaishnav worship. However, practitioners are more encouraged to engage in kirtan, the singing of mantras composed of names of God. The Vedas describe this not as a one-sided invocation from human to God, but as our response to his love call to enter the presence of the divine in his form of sacred sound. Love is a two-way experience freely given by both parties. So I ask myself, who might be hoping for my reciprocation? Is my partner or family, friends, or someone in need wondering if I will ever properly acknowledge, understand, or respond to their need or love call?
That was Thought for the Day with Akhandade Das. It brings us to just a tad before 10 to 8.
The mum of Jay Slater, the 19-year-old from Lancashire who went missing on holiday in Tenerife and was later found dead after falling into a ravine, has told me she wants to change the law to stop the online trolling of families involved in personal tragedies. The search for Jay took nearly a month, and in that time, Debbie Duncan and her family were bombarded with abuse. There were millions of posts containing conspiracy theories about what might have happened to him that were put online. At his inquest, he was found to have died an accidental death. Details like the fact that he'd taken drugs that night and that he had a criminal conviction for being involved in an attack on a man several years earlier had been picked up during the time that he was missing and used to fuel the many conspiracy theories that surrounded his disappearance. Well, Debbie told me, alongside her MP, Sarah Smith, who's helping her campaign for a change in the law, what it was like when the online world took hold of Jay's story.
Well, it was just a living nightmare, horrendous. And then obviously when all the online things started, the conspiracies, and it's kind of the facts were out there, but nobody wanted to believe the facts, the truth. And people, the online world, still don't want to, you know, believe the facts, the truth, what happened to Jay.
How much of that was getting to you? How many of those stories and those theories were actually finding their way to you and to your phone?
Well, I mean, my phone never stopped at the beginning, like prank calls, things like that. I mean, I didn't look at the social media side of it right at the beginning. I wasn't in a state to. But you know, there were videos put up, they were changing the voices, and oh, it was just one thing after another. But you were going down rabbit holes yourself, because you were, they were convincing, you know, they were very convincing.
I know that the people who were, I think, trying to help at the time put your phone number online in case anybody knew anything, if they had any information. But then that just opened you up even further in the end, didn't it? And I can see why you would want to answer those calls, because it might be something helpful. How do you know whether it is or it isn't?
So it was Jay's friend, Lucy, her mum. She'd made the missing poster, obviously not knowing what was to unfold. So, yeah, she'd put my number on and Jay's friend's numbers on, and we were all getting just inundated with calls, none of them useful, unfortunately. You know, I mean, social media were great, used correctly at the beginning to spread awareness, you know, asking for information when Jay were missing. It did spread far and wide. I mean, with the world's media on a doorstep, like within a few days, really.
What kind of support did you have at that time from people who would know how to deal with a situation like that? Was the police? Was anybody coming to you and saying, "Look, we will help you through this"?
Not really, no. To be honest, no. You know, I'd be ringing like our police, Lancashire police, but it was kind of out of their hands because it was a Spanish investigation, so they couldn't get involved. And I would, you know, I were begging them, I were pleading, please, somebody just come and sit with me and help me, because, like I said, my phone were just non-stop.
As the days went on and Jay's story spread and spread and people started to find out more about him, that he was a 19-year-old boy and he had a life and he had a past and he had a criminal record, and when people started to find those things out, did that change the level of trolling and abuse that you were getting?
It did, yeah. Yes, I mean, yeah, he had a criminal record, he was convicted. I mean, everybody knows that. At the time when that incident happened, it was in our newspapers, so that was a difficult time as it was. But yeah, obviously, when people found out about that, it was awful. You know, he deserved to die. And I think they just kind of judged Jay and his family, you know, because he did have that criminal record. It was like, oh, well, the family are, you know, they're not a normal family, which we were a normal family.
You know, for people who weren't in your position, the level of the abuse and the trolling that you received is, it's hard to comprehend, really. The things that people were saying, the fact that fake GoFundMe sites were being set up to try and raise money, they had to be closed down again. There were so many layers and levels of things going on for you, while at the same time, you just wanted to know where your son was and what had happened to him.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, there were a lot of bad publicity around the GoFundMe. I delayed, you know, putting comments on the GoFundMe page, because I knew I'd just get ripped to pieces, because, you know, I were accused of, you know, it were all a hoax and Jay were going to reappear at some point, if that were true, you know. But
it's like people forget that you're a human at the middle of it all, isn't it?
I know, yeah, that's the thing. Jay, he was like dehumanised. He was, you know, he was a story. Everything was just sensationalised, really.
And Sarah, you're working now with Debbie to try and change the law, because actually a lot of what she went through just wouldn't be allowed to happen in places other than the online world.
Yeah, exactly. If somebody was to stand on Debbie's doorstep and shout the things that they shout at her online, they would be removed by the police. That would be, you know, in breach of the law. If journalists were to print what people continue to write to this day, trying to speculate about what happened to Jay, they continue to try and perpetuate this kind of story, this true crime narrative. And I think that there should be, you know, a similar level of accountability for what people are saying online in these situations, because there is real harm that is caused.
That's one of the great difficulties, isn't it, now that the ability to just get a narrative out there has become so democratic. Anybody can do it. So how do you change it?
Debbie and I are going to meet, hopefully, and build a group of the victims who've been impacted in this way, and go from there in terms of how we design the legal solution to it. Because it is complicated, and, you know, ideally it could be done through Ofcom regulations, but if it needs obviously primary legislation, then that is what we will have to pursue. But we're still at the stage of working that out.
The online world is so huge and so unregulated. Do you think that this is something that you can achieve in a way that will make a difference?
It's not going to be easy, but I know how determined Debbie is to prevent other families going through the absolute hell that she continues to have to deal with.
It's going to be hard work, Debbie, but what does this mean to you if you could actually change things and stop it happening to somebody else?
Due to our horrendous experience, I would like to think that, yeah, we can get a law to prevent other families having to go through the pain that we've gone through. You know, the pain of losing Jay, the worst pain ever, losing a child. But to have to endure the rubbish on social media, I'm just hoping that there will be some legislation put in place and let these platforms, take responsibility and to remove malicious things targeting vulnerable families and grieving families.
Debbie Duncan and Sarah Smith, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that brings us to 3 minutes to eight. I should say, if you're following the cricket, or at least vaguely following it, there has been another wicket. I can tell you no more than that, but there we are. Let's see what Alex Forsyth does with that information, because she joins us now to tell us what's on this evening's Any Questions. Morning, Alex.
Morning, Justin. Not watching the cricket, I'm afraid. Tonight we are in Belfast at one of Northern Ireland's largest further and higher education colleges. And joining me there on the panel will be the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Hilary Benn, the Sinn Féin MLA, Declan Kearney, the DUP MLA, Peter Martin, and with less than a week to go until the Chancellor's budget, we have the Director of the CBI in Northern Ireland, Angela McGowan, who will no doubt have a view on what it all might mean for business and industry. We will be live at 8 p.m. I hope you can join us.
Thank you, Alex. Let's get some weather, shall we? Before the news, Sarah Keith-Lucas is back. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Anna. Well, it's been a very cold night, the coldest night of the season so far. It's been down to minus 12 at Loch Glasscarnock in the Highlands, but quite widely, actually, temperatures are several degrees below freezing. So a sharp frost and some icy stretches on any untreated surfaces this morning. Now, across England and Wales today, we have got a few coastal showers, particularly affecting Kent. There's some thunderstorms in the mix there, but also a few just close to the coast of North Yorkshire, but also the likes of Pembrokeshire down towards the Isles of Scilly and Cornwall as well. Away from these coastal areas, inland though, it is a dry start and lots of dry weather across England and Wales through today. Lots of blue sky and sunshine, in fact, but it's still going to feel chilly with temperatures here between about 5 to 8 degrees, but fairly light winds. Scotland and Northern Ireland, and after that bitterly cold start, we're seeing cloud increasing from the northwest as a weather front moving in. So some rain already across the Western Isles, and that rain will just creep slowly from the northwest across Northern Ireland and Scotland later into the day. There could be a little bit of snow to come, particularly for the Grampians, the Cairngorm Mountains, but at lower levels it will be falling as patchy rain, and it takes a while until the evening hours to spread right across Scotland and Northern Ireland. Temperatures here around 2 to 5 degrees. Overnight tonight won't be as cold as it was last night. There'll be more cloud and outbreaks of rain around. Milder air is on the way, so temperatures on the rise through the weekend, but it will be windy, especially on Sunday, with some heavy showers too.
Sarah, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4, Anna Foster in Salford and Justin Webb in London.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Friday the 21st of November. The headlines this morning, the energy price cap is to rise by 0.2% from January, despite analysts expecting it would fall during the winter. Figures show that government borrowing was £17.4 billion last month, the higher than official forecasts suggested. And Sir Keir Starmer says the government is looking very carefully at the latest report by the COVID inquiry to make sure that lessons are learned.
Also coming up in the next hour, with that news that the energy price cap is going to edge up in January, Martin Lewis, the money-saving expert, will tell us what it actually means for bills. Also, the story of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe is going to be told in a new BBC drama this week. We'll be talking to her husband, Richard Ratcliffe, and to the man playing him, Joseph Fiennes. The news is read this morning by Vijay Alice.
The regulator Ofgem has announced an unexpected rise in the energy price cap from January of 0.2%. It means a household in England, Wales or Scotland using a typical amount of energy will pay £1,758 a year, £3 higher than now. Analysts had predicted bills would fall slightly during the winter months. Here's our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey.
The sudden drop in temperature has brought the cost of gas and electricity to the forefront of people's minds once again. And at the height of winter, energy prices will edge up with a 0.2% rise in Ofgem's price cap. It comes into effect at the start of January and sets the maximum price for each unit of energy, not the total bill, so a cold winter could have a significant effect on what people pay. Ofgem said wholesale prices paid by suppliers were currently stable, but analysts at the consultancy Cornwall Insight have predicted the cap will rise again in April. Charities and campaigners say that means there needs to be longer-term action on getting bills down. The government has hinted at extra cost of living support in next week's budget, with a cut in VAT on energy bills said to be one option that's been considered.
Public sector borrowing was £17.4 billion last month, higher than analysts had been predicting. The figure from the Office for National Statistics was £1.8 billion less than a year earlier, but still the third highest October figure since records began in 1993. The government says it's working to get borrowing costs down. The Conservatives say if Labour had any backbone, it would control spending in order to avoid tax rises. Here's our business correspondent Theo Leggett.
These figures are unlikely to provide much comfort for the Chancellor ahead of her budget next week. Borrowing was lower in October than during the same period a year ago, but it was still higher than analysts had expected and above the Office for Budget Responsibility's forecasts. Day-to-day spending on goods and services went up, largely as a result of inflation and pay rises, while inflation-linked increases to benefits and pensions added to the government's outgoings. But this was outweighed by stronger tax receipts and the extra revenue brought in by higher employers' national insurance contributions. Borrowing for the financial year to the end of October was £9 billion more than last year. Analysts said the figures would not be helpful for Rachel Reeves, but pointed out that any tax increases in the budget would be based on what's expected to happen over the next few years.
Sir Keir Starmer says the UK must learn the lessons of COVID after the latest report from the COVID inquiry, which assessed the political response to the pandemic. It said computer modelling suggested that there would have been 23,000 fewer deaths in England had the first lockdown been introduced a week earlier. Here's our political correspondent Helen Catt.
The Prime Minister said the government was taking measures to make sure that it was prepared for any number of eventualities, although he had earlier warned that public services, including the NHS, had still not recovered from the pandemic. The Liberal Democrats said an apology was required and called on Kemi Badenoch to say sorry for the failings found in Boris Johnson's government. Mr Johnson has not commented on the inquiry's findings, neither have Rishi Sunak or Matt Hancock, who also faced criticism. Dominic Cummings, formerly the most senior aide at Number 10, was described as becoming a destabilising influence. He accused the inquiry of rewriting history.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has given a guarded response to new US proposals to end the war with Russia. He said Ukraine needed a true, dignified peace. Details of the plan have not been confirmed officially, but media reports indicate it's heavily based on Russia's demands. From Kyiv, here's our defense correspondent Jonathan Beale.
President Zelensky has been careful not to criticize or reject this US draft peace deal, even though it appears to heavily reflect many of Moscow's demands. In his nightly address, Mr. Zelensky said Ukraine needed peace and would engage in diplomacy and issue no rash statements. But there is deep concern about some of the reported proposals, including giving up the entire Donbass region, reducing the size of Ukraine's military, and ruling out the presence of international troops in the country. Europe appears to have had little say over the drafting of this plan, but wants its voice heard. There may not be much time. US officials who presented the plan, approved by President Trump, are said to be working to an aggressive timetable, with the hope of reaching an agreement within weeks.
Sir Keir Starmer has labelled Nigel Farage spineless and accused him of failing to adequately explain reports of racist and anti-Semitic comments it is alleged the Reform UK leader made when he was at school. It has prompted Mr Farage to claim Sir Keir is the weakest Prime Minister in living memory. The spat began as Sir Keir flew to the G20 summit in Johannesburg in South Africa. Our political editor Chris Mason is there.
Earlier this week, The Guardian said it had spoken to a number of Nigel Farage's contemporaries from the private Dulwich College in southeast London. The newspaper alleged that he had joked about gas chambers and put another pupil in detention when he was a prefect, because of the colour of their skin. Reform UK insisted the allegations were entirely without foundation. The Prime Minister told us Mr Farage hasn't got a good track record in relation to this, given one of Reform's MPs, Sarah Poachin, remained in the parliamentary party after remarks she made about the ethnicity of people in television adverts. Sir Keir Starmer said Nigel Farage should show some leadership when it comes to racism. Mr Farage said Sir Keir's criticisms were ludicrous. A Reform source said the Prime Minister was desperate, sinking in the polls and lashing out.
The National Crime Agency has warned that anyone buying cocaine in the UK could be indirectly funding Russian arms factories. Investigators have revealed that a money laundering network operating in the UK bought a bank to help Russia evade Western sanctions and channel funds towards its war machine. Our UK correspondent Daniel Sanford reports.
For years now, the National Crime Agency has been trying to undermine the work of two Russian-led money laundering networks operating in Britain. The networks exchange dirty money, made from drug deals, the supply of illegal weapons and people smuggling, for cryptocurrency. The NCA has now discovered that one of the networks, TGR, which is run by a man called George Rossi, had used a shell company to acquire a bank in Kyrgyzstan. The Keremet Bank has been helping Russian arms companies evade sanctions while they resupply the war in Ukraine.
The Colombian delegation at the COP30 climate summit in Brazil says more than 30 countries have signed a letter opposing a draft text because it fails to refer to the phasing out of fossil fuels. The leader of the talks is under pressure to come up with a text that all countries can agree on as the summit enters its final day. More details from our climate editor, Justin Rolat.
The summit was delayed yesterday after a fire broke out in the conference centre. The intense blaze was swiftly brought under control, but it meant yet another delay to these already fraught talks. The most contentious issues are the yawning gap between what countries say they'll do and what the science says is necessary to tackle climate change, and how to get rich countries to deliver on promised cash to help poorer countries play their part. It is supposed to end tonight at 9 p.m. UK time, but don't hold your breath. These conferences almost always overrun.
The first Ashes test in Perth has got off to a dramatic start, with Australia's Mitchell Starc snapping up 7 wickets. Before tea, England were bowled out for 172. Australia in reply are 38 for 4. A charity building a replica of the world-famous Sutton Hoo burial ship is asking members of the public to suggest names for the vessel. The ship is believed to have been a burial chamber for an Anglo-Saxon king and lay undiscovered for centuries in the Suffolk countryside. Joe Black reports.
The replica ship currently sits in a shed in Woodbridge in Suffolk and is around a year off completion. Since 2021, a team of 180 volunteers has worked on the project to construct a tribute to the Anglo-Saxon longship discovered in the ground at Sutton Hoo in 1939. When it was unearthed, the timber of the original had dissolved in the ground and a ghostly imprint remained. A hoard of treasures found with the boat suggested it was the burial of someone important. The public is being invited to submit names for the reconstructed vessel. Only when she's launched will the winner be revealed.
Joe Black reporting.
Thank you for that. It is 8:10. COVID-19 is a potentially serious disease, particularly for elderly people. It killed 227,000 people during the pandemic in the UK. Many of them died. The COVID Now inquiry is now telling us because the response to the coming calamity was so poor. Politicians and civil servants let us down, Lady Hallett suggests. Boris Johnson, as Prime Minister, presided over a toxic, sexist and chaotic culture. She goes as far as to say that the stringent lockdowns might not have been necessary if action had been taken earlier. And she says the impact of the lockdown, particularly on children, was not appreciated. Dominic Cummings, Boris Johnson's chief advisor, is accused of creating a culture of fear and mutual suspicion. He's already responded. He said the inquiry was a mix of cover-ups and rewriting history. And on this programme half an hour ago, Professor Carl Hennigan, who was sceptical about lockdown, said the inquiry had not properly assessed whether they worked. Let us talk to Lord Gove, Michael Gove, who was part of a committee of cabinet ministers that made decisions on the COVID-19 pandemic. He was chair of the COVID-19 operations subcommittee, but he was at the same time a cabinet minister with wider responsibilities. Lord Gove, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Justin.
The first point, which is such an important one, isn't it, about the wasted February, as the inquiry puts it. Do you agree that if there had been action taken earlier, the later lockdowns need not have been as stringent?
Well, first of all, can I just take the opportunity which you've given me to apologise to all those who lost loved ones during the pandemic, and to many others who made huge sacrifices, who will feel, I'm sure, a sense of not just grief but understandable anger as they read some of the conclusions in this report. And I want to, on behalf of the government and the Conservative Party, to apologise for mistakes that were made during that period. I think, however, that if we look at the report overall, 800 pages, it would be wrong to oversimplify some of the conclusions. And I think in particular that if we had locked down earlier, I think that would have been wiser. And I did say so at the time, but I think it is one thing to say that it would have been more prudent to have locked down a week earlier, but it's quite another to make the leap to claim that 27,000 lives would have been saved as a result.
Yeah. 23,000.
23,000, yeah. Forgive me.
Yeah.
Let alone that future lockdowns would not have been necessary, because it's certainly the case that some form of restriction on social mixing and personal liberty was always going to be required in order to suppress the spread of the virus.
Can we just focus on the 23,000 figure for a moment? Because Carl Hennigan, Professor Hennigan, told us earlier in the programme, you just can't know whether that is true or not. But the consequences, I mean, if you read the Times editorial today on Boris Johnson, it says that figure attaches to him and it means that he may never come back into British politics and at some future point lead the Conservative Party, etc. Do you reject that? Do you say this 23,000 figure cannot be hung on his neck or indeed the necks of any of you?
Yes, that's not to take away any responsibility for the mistakes that were made during the pandemic by me and by others. Absolutely not. But I think that this particular figure, as Carl Hennigan pointed out, was a projection, not a prediction. And the inquiry report itself, helpfully, makes clear that we need a better understanding of how modelling works. During the course of the pandemic, models, which were thoughtful scientific projections of what might happen, were sometimes treated as though they were cast iron predictions of what would happen. And it's in the very nature of science that as new facts emerge, you adjust models in order to be either more pessimistic or optimistic. And the second thing is, I think that the singular focus on Boris Johnson, I think, distorts the complexity of decision-making.
Do you think his political career is ended by this section of the report or not?
I don't think it should be, no, because I think that a more important point to bear in mind overall is that while Boris's style of decision-making was not to everyone's taste, what he was doing was wrestling, as everyone now recognises, with an enormously difficult question about the curtailment of liberty versus the maintenance of access to healthcare. More than that, without his drive, we would not have had the vaccine rollout that was responsible for ensuring that we were the first country to be able to put jabs in arms.
A drive, but also a toxic, sexist, chaotic culture. Do you accept that the culture led to deaths that need not otherwise have taken place?
No, I don't accept that either. I do certainly think that there were moments when voices were raised, words were used, attitudes were struck that were far from ideal. But the business of government during a crisis can't be carried on in the manner of a Jane Austen novel. It's the case that we were dealing with, as everyone across the world was, an unprecedented crisis with a novel virus, which most intelligence agencies now believe was a lab leak rather than a naturally occurring virus. And of course, under pressure, with imperfect information, mistakes are made, voices are raised. But again, Dominic Cummings, who comes under some criticism, was the person who was, more than anyone, responsible for ensuring that the data was accurately and thoroughly interrogated by decision makers. So in any judgment overall, and to be fair again, in detail, the inquiry makes clear that his interventions in March were critical in putting in place the measures necessary to suppress the spread of the virus.
There's a big difference, isn't there? You say in detail, and you've pointed out as well, the inquiry is long and very detailed and goes into a lot of detail about the decision-making processes, but the headlines are different, aren't they? The headlines are that you were basically all running around like headless chickens. You didn't know what you were doing at crucial moments, and that led to death. So my question to you, has this inquiry actually treated you as a government unfairly?
No, I don't believe so. I think that, again, while it's open, and I'm sure that the inquiry chair, Heather Hallett, would acknowledge this, to draw different conclusions from the mass of information that she's gathered helpfully and thoughtfully and synthesised, that it's always incumbent on the chair of an inquiry to sum it up. And when you are dealing with a situation as complex and still as contested as the question of lockdowns and decision-making.
But that's the point, isn't it? That's the point Carl Hennig was making earlier in the programme. He says it's asked the wrong questions. There was a fascination with who said what to whom and whether they used bad language and all the rest of it. But actually, he made the point that we still don't really know whether lockdowns worked or not. And that should have been the focus of the inquiry.
I think that Carl Hennig makes a very fair point. And I think that there is only so much that we can expect from a judge-led inquiry. I don't think that's any criticism of Heather Hallett or the people who've been working on it to say that there are other questions, particularly a comparison between the steps that we took in the United Kingdom and the steps that other countries took in order to look at how effectively we could have curtailed the spread of the virus.
Do you think Sweden got it right? Which is what a lot of sceptics about lockdowns have long said, and indeed some of them said at the time. So Sweden did have measures to restrict people, but they were voluntary in some respects and they were also milder, basically.
I think that there's been a profound misunderstanding amongst some of what happened in Sweden. And indeed, Anders Tegnell, who was the Swedish medic in charge of their response, makes it clear, actually, in the report that there was a misunderstanding. You're right, broadly, that in Sweden there was a greater emphasis on voluntary restraint rather than the use of the criminal law. In this country, and this goes to the heart of the findings at the beginning, we tried a level of voluntary restraint, but we weren't sure at that point if that was going to reduce social mixing by enough, hence the need for tougher measures. But it's not the case that Sweden took, as you rightly point out, a laissez-faire approach. Mm. The other thing also is that the instance of death is linked not just to the spread of the virus, but also to what scientists, medics call comorbidities. In crude terms, because Britain is fatter, and because Britain is more diverse, and because Britain is more economically unequal than Sweden, we were more vulnerable to the virus anyway.
What does all of this tell us about ourselves as people? We were remembering talking about this earlier on. The extraordinary things that happened during lockdowns, the way in which individuals, for what they thought were right reasons at the time, reported each other, shouted at people who didn't wear masks, etc., etc., etc. As a nation, what did it tell us? What does it tell us now with a bit of hindsight?
Well, I think the most important thing, you're right, there is an unfortunate tendency amongst some people to have the... whenever authority exerts its heavy foot, there are some people who overdo it.
A lot of people, it turned out, didn't it? A surprising number of people, would you say?
I find that, you know, it's part of human nature and it's not attractive. But I do think that the most important thing to bear in mind, put the government to one side, is the fact that public servants, whether that was in the NHS or the people who were responsible for delivering food to the shielded vulnerable, or those who strove to ensure that children, albeit at home, were taught appropriately remotely, people in public service and people in the vital industries that kept this country going, behaved with great stoicism and dignity and application. And that is the main thing I'd like to take away about the country. That's not to exempt the government of which I was part from criticisms, and it's not to wish away the unfortunate tendency in human nature that you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, cause that's the positive side. People were stepped up in extraordinary numbers, in extraordinary ways, right throughout the country, in all sorts of roles as well. But it is really striking, isn't it? And when you look back on this period, and you talk about the lockdowns and the way they were policed as well, that There was this undercurrent, wasn't there, of quite authoritarian behaviour, and not from the government, actually.
No.
But it came from individuals.
From individuals. And again, this goes to the heart of it, which is, I think most people would agree, including Carl Hennigan, who was something of a sceptic, but is a thoughtful scientist, that the virus was spread by social mixing. It was spread through the air by people being too close to one another. In order to stop the spread of the virus, you had to limit that. Now, whether or not the steps that were taken and the use of the criminal law was too heavy-handed a measure is, I think, absolutely at the heart of this debate. And, of course, as the representative from one of the teaching unions pointed out, the people who bore the biggest brunt from the restrictions on social mixing were children. Now, it's important to recognise that while children themselves were the least likely to suffer from the virus, it was also the case that schools being open contributed to the spread of the virus. And I think one of the conclusions, and it's a tentative one at this stage, would be were there to be anything like this pandemic again, we should work even harder to keep schools open. But that might mean other restrictions on social mixing elsewhere, whether or not it's the criminal law that enforces them.
You said right at the start that the discussion about where it originated, whether it was a lab leak, etc., was now something, I think you said that you thought it was now a lab leak.
Yes.
Well, that seems to be the problem. Should we talk more about that? I mean, is that something that should be discussed more? Because, of course, at the time, it was actually suppressed as a theory. It was suppressed online. People weren't allowed to say it.
Completely. So there was a reluctance, more than a reluctance, to acknowledge that this might be the case. It's now the view of most intelligence agencies, and it raises two profound questions. If it was a lab leak, if it was potentially a man-made virus, then what scientists call the etiology of it needs to be studied to better understand it. Because, again, it's way above my pay grade to understand, but a man-made virus will behave differently from a naturally occurring zoonotic virus. The second thing is, it also raises profound questions about our relationship with China. I don't think it's any surprise to listeners of this programme to know that China does not always act in the best interests of this country or indeed the globe. But if it was the case that this was a lab leak, it is another reason for us to be extraordinarily wary in our dealings with the Chinese regime.
Okay. And it is, of course, an if. There will be scientists on both sides of that discussion, but at least it is now a discussion. Lord Gove, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, listening to that is Liz Kendall, the Technology Secretary, who are going to talk to you about AI in just a moment. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just on the point of COVID, first of all, you heard what Michael Gove had to say there. And these were also not the failings of your government. This was the previous government, the Conservative government, that was making these mistakes and these decisions. However, there is one figure, Sir Chris Wormald, who at the time was the civil servant in charge of the Department of Health. He is now the cabinet secretary. He's been promoted by Sir Keir Starmer, and he has been identified as failing in his role at the time of the pandemic. Is it appropriate for him to continue to be the head of the civil service in light of that?
Yes. I mean, Chris has, I think, spoken for himself about this, and he continues to do excellent work across government, including learning the lessons from this pandemic and making sure we are as fully prepared as we possibly can be for the future. I thought it was interesting there that Michael Gove essentially sort of accepted that the criticisms of the Conservative government were fair.
If you don't mind, Liz Kendall, I don't want to deviate too far from this particular point on Sir Chris Wormald, because I have the feeling that if, for example, Boris Johnson or Matt Hancock or Dominic Cummings, for example, were still in a role, a position of power, that you would be calling for them to go as a result of this. And I can't see why you feel it is appropriate to defend somebody to whose name the word failure has been attached by this very important inquiry.
Well, the cabinet secretary, as you know, has himself spoken about these issues. He continues to do a really important work for the government. But let me just say this. You're right that this happened under the previous Conservative government. We're determined to learn all the lessons that we can. And one of the most important things that's come out of this inquiry is the importance of science, of scientific expertise and scientific advice. And we need to make sure that we listen to that as a government. And that is exactly what we are doing. There is much we can learn, but we need to back British scientists, British experts that some, I would have to say, including Michael Gove, disparaged in the past, to make sure that we do everything we can to prevent these sorts of issues happening again. We've already run a big exercise.
But not removing somebody who was branded a failure from a very important job. OK, let's talk about AI, because that is what you're here to talk about a new investment. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, the government is and you as the Secretary of State for Technology are focusing on this. I think 100 million is going in total. But when you look at what the tech sector is putting in terms of figures, they're putting in an awful lot more. Should the government be focusing more on this, spending more money?
We're actually doing much more than that. There's several things we're announcing today. First is another AI growth zone. That's a centre of expertise on AI backed by the infrastructure, the data centres in South Wales, bringing in more than £10 billion of additional investment and creating more than 5,000 jobs. But we're also announcing how we are going to do more to back British companies to move from startups to scale them up and to ensure those companies are part of leading this technological revolution and also
and
supporting
how much money will you put into that?
Well, there's two things we're announcing today. Firstly is a new advanced market commitment backed by at this stage at least £100 million, so that companies that develop chips, which we know are vital to AI, that they get that sort of agreement for backing from the government to leverage in private sector investment, but also the chair of a new sovereign AI unit, which has £500 million to invest in that sovereign capability. That's capability on this shores for our economy and for national security. Mm. We are also looking at how we can leverage government procurement too to back
British companies.
The
figures are still really interesting though, aren't they? Because if you look at NVIDIA, the US chip manufacturer, their results show that they made $57 billion in just 3 months. So that the scale is very, very different, isn't it, with where AI is going and how much money the UK government is investing in it.
You're right to say that, but it's not just about the government investment. Actually, it's about investment from the private sector. And so far this year, we've seen more venture capital funding for British AI and tech companies than France, Germany and Switzerland combined. But what we are saying is the government is doing more to support those British companies in the hardware, in the chips, but also in applying AI. And that, I think, is the key thing here. This technology will have a huge impact on our economy, but also our public services and scientific research. We need to build the infrastructure, that's the data centres, but crucially, we need to spread the adoption of AI. Because when you see when businesses use it and when researchers use it, it can really make a difference. We are in a race for the future here. We want to make sure that we focus AI on our key strengths, life sciences, financial services, the defence and creative sectors. So we use AI in those existing strengths and spread it to all parts of the country, because that is the key to getting growth.
Liz Kendall, the Technology Secretary. I know you've got to go now. Thank you for joining us.
29 minutes past eight. Without further ado, to Jonathan, who's been hopping about with excitement in the last hour or two.
Really? There was a lot going on. I mean, after all the hype in the build-up, were you thinking, could the Ashes possibly live up to its five-star billing? You'd better believe it.
Woods there with his open stance. Stark runs in towards him and he swings at this. He's hit it straight up in the air. Carey's underneath it. He takes it. All out. Oh, England all out. Not with a bang, baby. With a big whimper. That is terrible. All out for 172.
The great Australian commentator Jim Maxwell reeling from another England batting collapse. Just to put a bit more flesh, Zach Crawley out in the first over, naught. Joe Root out for naught. Just four England batsmen reached double figures. Harry Brook top scored with 52, Ollie Pope 46. England all out in 33.5 overs. Australia's Mitchell Starc finishing with career best figures of 7 for 58. But England's bowlers are fighting back in style. Let's go to Jim now in the Perth Stadium. Good afternoon there, Jim, as it is with you.
Yes, we're just having a drinks break on the moment of a Cameron Green collapse towards his stumps after getting a rocket from Wood. He couldn't get out of the way of it and it hit him in the helmet So they're out there doing the concussion stuff now. But he very nearly walked into his stumps as he reeled away from this vicious short ball. And there have been a number of ball-hugging deliveries from England. They've been right at the Australians. Archer's been superb. He's taken 2 for 7, passed 2 for 20. And alas, Atkinson just dropped a caught and bowled opportunity from Green a few overs back. But Australia on the back foot at 4 for 53. Smith is out. Head and Green are there at the moment. But it's a fairly tenuous experience for batsmen today on this pitch with a bit of grass and some bounce. There has to be said, the lower order England batting was very poor. But Brook gave us some entertainment with his half century, and so did Pope with 46 and Smith 30-odd. But what a day. What a day we've seen. 14 wickets fall today for 225 runs, and we've still got an hour to play. But England have bounced back from a disappointing performance after winning the toss and batting, and Australia on the back foot at 4 for 53.
Jim, what's a good score then? Have we got any indication at all? I mean, because you clearly were not impressed by what England are doing, and at the moment, Australia aren't doing much better.
This is almost a repetition of the Indian test here last year on a pitch that had a bit more excitement because it was damp. But on that day, 17 wickets fell on the first day. Australia was 7 for 67 in reply to 150. A bloke called Bumrah got quite a few wickets. And after that, it all settled down. It was calmer, and India went on to record a very famous victory. I don't know what's going to happen from here. If it gets to the fifth day, it'll be a miracle, you would think. But this pitch, yes, of course, it'll flatten out. It's going to be good to bat on. Well, we'll see. At the moment, it's a damn minefield for batting because the bowling is fast, seriously fast, threatening the body and the stumps and the edge. And this is creating, for 50,000 people in the stadium, the most exhilarating cricket you could imagine.
You can hardly hear yourself think, can you? It's like going to a concert by the sound. It's like this resounding beat the whole time.
Well, it's like Oasis being back here in Perth. They were here the other day and the mob were roaring. They've been roaring here all day. Australians and English fans have had their moments of serious adrenaline and going completely off about what is happening in the middle. And the action's about to resume. And Mark Wood's the one who's got the ball. He just whacked Cameron Green in the head, and he's rushing in towards Green again. And another short ball. This time he's parried it off to point. But you want to be here. You really do want to be here.
Well, you've set the scene magnificently. Jim Maxwell, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. Test Match Special continues. An hour and a half still to play. Where else would you want to go apart from, obviously, Justin, listening to you? We get it.
Where else indeed would you want to be? The weather today sees a cold and bright start for most of us. It will be cold as well. Just the odd shower around for western and North Sea coast, but cloud will build a little bit later across the northwest, which should bring some more patchy rain.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Justin Webb in London. It has just come up to 26 minutes to 9. Let's have the news from Vigialis.
The regulator Ofgem has announced that the energy price cap will increase slightly from January. A household in England, Scotland and Wales using a typical amount of energy will pay £1,758 a year, £3 higher than now. Public sector borrowing was £17.4 billion last month. That's £1.8 billion less than the same time last year, but still the third highest October figure since records began in 1993. Sir Keir Starmer says the government is taking measures to ensure it is prepared for future public health crises after a COVID inquiry report criticised the political response to the pandemic. It said 23,000 fewer people would have died had the first lockdown in March 2020 been introduced earlier. Lord Gove, who was a cabinet minister during the pandemic, told this programme that while implementing a lockdown sooner would have been wiser, he believed it was a leap to claim that so many lives would have been saved. And Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has given a guarded response to new US proposals to end the war with Russia. Unconfirmed reports say the plan is heavily based on Moscow's demands.
Thank you, Vij. It's 25 to 9. The energy price cap for England, Wales and Scotland this winter will be 0.2% higher from January. It means that a household using a typical amount of energy will pay £1,758 a year, which is £3 higher than now. But of course, those figures on their own are, as always, only part of the story, really. So here to give us the full context so you know what they mean for you is Martin Lewis, founder of Money Saving Expert. Morning, Martin.
Morning. I'd say they're not even part of the story. They're none of the story. The energy price cap we're talking about only lasts 3 months. So to give an annual figure is completely nonsense. I mean, this is a much bigger story than it looks on that headline, 0.2% rise. What's actually happening is electricity unit rates are going up 5%. The electricity standing charge, the daily charge you pay just for the facility of having electricity, is going up 2%. The gas standing charge is going up 3%, and the gas unit rate, the amount you pay for each unit of gas, is going down 6%. So those people who use more electricity than gas or only have electricity are actually going to see a rise of 3 to 4% in January. The average, the typical 0.2% does not tell the story. And what's really, I mean, just perverse here is the reason we're seeing those costs go up on electricity is not the normal reason of wholesale rates, the cost that gas and electricity firms pay to buy in energy. That's gone down over the three-month assessment period. These are policy costs. These are the costs of the warm home discount. These are the costs of connecting renewables to the network. These are the costs of nuclear power being put on board. These are all policy costs and network costs. So here we are in a time when the government's stated policy is to reduce the usage of gas and encourage people onto heat pumps, that what we are doing is artificially putting up the cost of electricity and reducing the cost of gas so that gas is relatively cheaper, which is, of course, clearly a perverse incentive that's going to encourage more people to use gas. More so, this is a regressive way to pay for policy. Energy bills are regressive. Wealthier people do not see pay as much a proportion of their income on energy as poorer people do. So the fact we are choosing to put the policy costs, and this is going to happen even more, the prediction is the 4 or 5% rise in April, the fact we're choosing to put the policy costs onto electricity bills as opposed to pay for the amount of general taxation, which is more progressive. We need a national debate about this because these policy costs are going to make up an ever bigger proportion of our bills. The wholesale costs, the costs you're actually paying for the energy firms are paying, is making up a smaller proportion. And this particular price cap announcement just shows the ludicrousness of the situation.
Martin, this is a layman's question, although most of mine on this topic tend to be. Why, if it's policy choices, is there a way that they could not do that in the winter, because that's when people are using their gas, their electricity, a lot of it goes on heating? Is it something that could just be, and you've made it clear that you don't think that's the right way to do it anyway, but is there an argument for just doing it in the summer months if that's the way they want to do it?
They're doing it in every month and it's going to go well. The current prediction is we're going to see a rise of 4 to 5% in April because of policy costs. And it's going to keep going up. And, you know, the likelihood is with the move that we have towards renewables and improving our infrastructure on energy, we're going to continue to see policy costs rise probably until the mid-2030s. So it isn't a seasonal thing. It's a constant thing. And that's why I think we now need to have a national debate about how we pay for energy policy, because we're paying for it on electricity bills. And as well as the perverseness, as I've said, of the differential between gas and electricity, when that goes against what we're trying to do with policy, we also have to look at the regressive nature of it. I mean, I should do what I do for my proper job, which is tell people what they should be doing right now. Look, these bills are going up 0.2%. The prediction is they're going up again in the April price cap of around 4 or 5%, and then they're going to stay static after that. The cheapest fixes on the market right now are 10% cheaper than the energy price cap. The energy price cap is a pants cap. You should not be on it if you possibly can get off it. I would suggest you get onto a whole of market comparison site like My Cheap Energy Club or one of the others out there, but I'd probably do it next week because I hear cheaper tariffs are coming in next week. There are people who have to be on the price cap. Those are the people who are on old school prepayment meters because there's no choice. But for everyone else, either get yourself onto a fix or a cheap time of use tariff or an EV tariff. If you're on the price cap, it's a pants cap and you are paying too much. So you should also get off it.
Yeah, just shop around. It's always the key, isn't it? Just a very, very, very quick thought. The energy price cap, which was brought in a couple of years ago, is there still a future for that?
Well, until we bring in the social tariff, which is the what I've actually always called for, you know, we have a problem in energy. We have to look at who are the legitimate victims of a competitive market. You, Anna, forgive me. If you chose not to switch and stay on the price cap, that's your problem. You're perfectly capable of switching. And you, if you haven't done it out of, you know, just not being bothered, that would be your problem. But a struggling 92-year-old grandpa with onset dementia who's not capable of accessing a competitive market needs protection. The price cap was brought in as a backstop for those people, though it is too expensive for that particular job. The problem is now two-thirds of homes are on the price cap, even though it was only meant to be a backstop. I would like to see a social tariff where those people who are illegitimate victims of competition, the vulnerable who can't switch and can't engage in the competitive market, are given much better pricing. And then if we're going to have a market-based system, and I'm agnostic to whether we do that or we do actually just regulate or nationalize the whole thing, but if we're going to have a market-based system, then you need proper competition, and the price cap is a weird halfway house. So there is a future for the price cap, because what we really need is a social tariff, but unfortunately I'm not seeing any moves towards a social tariff to protect the vulnerable.
Martin Lewis, thank you as always. Worth letting you know what the government say as well. The Minister for Energy Consumers, Martin McCluskey, said, we know that energy bills remain too high. He points towards the expanded warm home discount that Martin was talking about, that's reflected in the bills, in the change in the price cap. Martin McCluskey says, we're taking long-term action to bring down bills for good with the government's clean power mission. We're also delivering our new golden age, he says, of nuclear with cheaper, clean electricity to power millions of homes, kickstart economic growth and create thousands of jobs.
19 minutes to nine. The first men will today be invited to join what they're calling a game-changing prostate cancer screening trial. It's going to revolutionise care, they say, and save potentially thousands of lives a year in the UK. Professor Hashim Ahmed is here, who's chair of urology at Imperial College London and the chief investigator for the Transform trial. Good morning to you, Professor.
Morning.
What are you actually going to do?
So Transform, which is funded by Prostate Cancer UK and the government's National Institute of Health Research, is going to, in its first stage, invite up to 16,000 men. And what we're going to try and do is find the best way to screen. There's been a raging debate, as you've covered many times over the last year, as to whether we should be finding prostate cancer early with a screening program. And that raging debate is because we know screening can save lives if you use the PSA blood test, but that pathway, that way of screening, can lead to a lot of harms. Harms of testing and harms of treatment. And those harms at the moment outweigh the small benefit in improving survival. So we need to do better. And in Transform, we're going to find the best way to reduce those harms, improve on the benefit. So we think PSA blood tests can miss important cancers as well. And our new approach, which is to use a combination of PSA testing as well as a short 10-minute MRI scan or a spit test to look at genetic risk, will be the best combination going forward.
And are you, so for your trial, are you dividing people up? You're going to have a control group, you don't do these things, do what? How is it going to actually work?
Correct. So we're going to invite men to take part, and then we're going to assign them to different groups, because that's the only way we can find out truly what the benefit of these new approaches are, including the current approach. And we have to compare it to men who are going about their normal daily lives, who may not be getting PSA testing, because that's the only way we can show whether there is a benefit over the long term and that the harms are better than what we're currently doing.
Yeah, but it's still going to be a balance, isn't it? I mean, your study is obviously worth doing, and it's worth getting any hard information you can. But at the end of the day, there will still be some harms, won't there, that you'll be identifying, that you'll be able to identify, and some benefits as well.
So with any public health intervention, when you start to go out to the population, the equation changes. You're always going to cause some harm to men, in this case, who don't need to be tested, who don't need to be treated. And that balance at the moment, despite what's been said, is not quite right. And we need to redress that balance.
Well, one somewhat confusing aspect of this is that separately, and I think it is completely separate, isn't it? The government is expected to make an announcement about screening coming up. So we appear to be moving towards screening before your trial is able to tell us the rights and wrongs of it.
So the National Screening Committee have been asked, and they do a normal cycle of review of the evidence anyway, and they've been looking at the evidence over the last year. That will be announced in the next 1 or 2 weeks, I believe. I don't know what they will say. What I will say is that the evidence since they last looked at prostate cancer screening hasn't significantly changed, again, despite what others might be saying. So we'll see what they say. They are the best people and they're best placed to make that judgment as to what society, what policymakers should be doing. That balance between harms, benefits, and importantly, costs and cost effectiveness, because with any large population intervention, sure, we do have to think, yeah, about that.
Professor Hashim Ahmed from Imperial College London, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's 14 minutes to nine.
Now, a new TV drama based on the six-year imprisonment of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe in Iran starts this weekend on the BBC. Prisoner 951. It's a factual drama. It's based on the extraordinary true story of Nazanin herself, but also of her family. She was held hostage, essentially, by the Iranian state for 6 years. Her husband, Richard Ratcliffe, campaigned for justice and for her return. You will have heard him often on this programme doing those things. You might remember the moment that she landed back in the UK in March 2022. So she landed with another released British-Iranian prisoner, Anoush Ashouri. It was captured by Elika, who's Anoush's daughter. You can hear now the moment that Nazanin's daughter, Gabriella, sees her mother for the first time.
That's my dad.
That's Nazanin.
Yeah.
It was quite a moment. The video then shows Gabriella, who was seven at the time, rushing to hug her mother she hadn't seen in years. You can also hear Richard in the background here. This is a scene from Prisoner 951 where Richard, played by Joseph Fiennes, holds a press conference to talk about Nazanin being held.
Thank you for coming. Today marks the 100th day of Nazanin's abduction. For 100 days, a mother, a British citizen, has been held inside an Iranian prison, willfully separated from her child. The intelligence services are admitting that they are detaining a mother and baby, not because of any suspicious activity in Iran, but as collateral for an unknown political deal. And they have asked me to make this unknown deal known to you, the media.
Richard Ratcliffe, the real one, is here. And so is Joseph Fiennes, the actor who plays him in the series. And so is Philippa Lothorpe, who is the award-winning director of the whole series. Welcome to you all. Richard, first of all, when the idea came to do it, your thinking was what?
Morning. That's a good question, actually. Obviously, you're right. I've been on this show many times. I've been campaigning for many times. And part of me wanted to tell the full story, if that makes sense. And there's probably a story like ours is bonkers, and it's got all these different dimensions, and there was all these things that happened, and there was a need to process and make sense of that, and then want to tell that story. And partly that was to share the story with all the people that cared and helped Nazanin come home, because it took a lot of people's kindness and support around the country. And part of it was probably because other people do go through similar things. There are British citizens being held in Iran still, and wanting almost the lessons to be learned from our case. Yeah. So that was the motive, and they've done an amazing job.
And Philippa, drama, as we know from the post office scandal, but we know more broadly as well, drama really works, doesn't it, in bringing home to people something that you might read about occasionally and think about occasionally, but hasn't actually hit home viscerally.
I think that's so true. I mean, I've always been attracted to making true stories. I made the drama Three Girls some years ago, which had a similar effect as the post office drama. But I feel like with a drama, and it's obviously based on the words of Richard and Nazanin and all the manuscript of their book that's shortly to come out, I think it can reach a kind of emotional truth that you perhaps don't get in the factual thing of a little news bulletin or something like that. It can really hit you what they actually went through, and it definitely hit me in the making of it.
Joseph Fiennes, why did you agree to do it? What was it that attracted you to the idea of playing Richard?
Well, good morning. A host of
of factors converging together, two of which are on either side of me, Richard and Philippa. Richard's extraordinary and his wife's extraordinary and daughter's experience, ordinary people thrust into extraordinary circumstances, which reflects upon our sort of geopolitical landscape, and Philippa's extraordinary work as a director, along with Stephen Butchard, our writer, bringing together a very taut, you could say, political thriller. I knew the case, but not to the depth and breadth and detail, I found it very deeply shocking and moving. And so I read the script, and I knew with the sort of team that we had, this was going to be a very special and important piece.
Philippa, how did you approach doing it?
By doing a lot of research, along with Richard and Nazanin, and with Stephen Butchard, the writer. We had the manuscript of the book, and every single word in that book was like a Bible to me. I read, first of all, read Nazanin's chapters that she'd written about her experiences, which were so incredibly vivid and so overwhelmingly moving. That was my real Bible. And then we spoke to family members. We spoke to Richard's lawyer, Penny Madden. We did umpteen interviews with other people. And it was a very heavily researched piece, as well as using your work, Richard, and Nazanin's.
How much does it explore, Richard, and how much does it reveal to us about the way you were approaching it here in your circumstances and the way Nazanin was approaching it where she was in her circumstances? And when you met again, the differences of perspective that there must have been.
Yeah, I think it does a really good job of that balance, in that you've got the disorientation and trauma of what's happening in Iran, and it doesn't make any sense, and how scary that is. And the sort of disorientation and journey towards, I mean, I suppose at the beginning, not knowing what's going on, being confused, then as you see sort of Joseph's portrayal, I get angrier and then I get quite mobilised. And so you get those two things jumping between both sides, where you've got a family trying to hold on, but living different experiences. In terms of how much the putting together the pieces afterwards, that's probably something that happens after the end of the drama. The drama stops at reunion, and that's probably a bit of a work in progress, if we're honest.
Yes, I'm sure it is. Joseph, there is a personal, and you can see the attraction to an actor of capturing the personal side of it. But the politics is interesting, isn't it? And the just the kind of raw fact that people can be, in effect, taken hostage by the state, and getting us to think about that and thinking about that as a reality, not just with Iran, other states as well, and other states through history.
Quite right, yeah. I mean, it's a frightening prospect, and certainly was a wake-up call for me being involved in the project and sitting down with Richard, who very kindly gave me several hours of his time in preparation, but to understand that state hostage-taking does take place, and innocent individuals, in this case, who happen just to carry a dual passport, were taken off the streets and separated. And so that clearly goes on. And you'd like to think, oh, that goes on in other countries. But the silence that Richard was subjected to, I felt, this is my personal perspective, by the Foreign Office in dealing with this, I found that heartbreaking to watch the play out over several years. And of course, Richard had to go through this sort of revolving doors of ministers coming in and out, who, when you eventually sit down with them, they're out, they're through the revolving door again. And so it's years of someone's life being taken up. I found that prospect and aspect frustrating to see.
Philippa, one of the things, I mean, we used to say regularly when we were talking to Richard, we would say she's in prison, the circumstances aren't great, the way she's being held isn't right, etc., etc., etc. What you've done is we get a bit more detail, don't we, actually, about the experience of her being in prison.
That's absolutely true. It was vitally important for me in the drama, and for Richard, actually, and Nazanin, to show Nazanin's side of the story, the untold bit of the story, because we knew little bits, didn't we? But we didn't know actually what had happened to her. And the detail of that is incredibly shocking.
Detail like what?
Like the fact that I didn't know, for example, that she was held, when she was held in Evin, whenever she was moved around, she was blindfolded. Or when she was transferred to another prison care man, she was blindfolded. She never knew where she was. So that sort of a method of torture, of disorientation, was used upon Nazanin. There's a heartbreaking scene where she's transferred back to Evin, and a judge in an office says, "Do you know where you are?" And she says, "No." And he says, "You're in Evin." And he draws a picture for her and says, "You're in Security Ward 2A. And that's absolutely true. It's from Nazanin's work. And it's, I really wanted the audience to know what she'd suffered, really to look at what had happened to her, because it's absolutely heartbreaking and totally shocking.
Is it cathartic, Richard, for both of you? I mean, speaking for yourself, first of all.
Yeah, I mean, mixed is probably... So I find it's been very cathartic for me to put the pieces together. And it's sort of... living it felt like a big jigsaw that I couldn't make sense of. So having Nazanin's understanding and what she went through and how things happened at different points. I mean, none of us like to dwell on bad times. So it's, you know... Some of reliving the past is remembering stuff that I'd forgotten away. And certainly for Nazanin, some of what she went through is awful. So there's a trepidation sometimes with parts of it. And certainly when I came to watch the sort of earlier versions of it with Philippa and that was hard.
What does Nazanin think of it?
So she's... We sort of went through in great detail the script and went through in great detail on the different parts. But she's sort of waiting to watch the whole thing until, you know, see how Mum copes with it and how, you know, we cope with it. And it's a big thing. It's a big thing. And it's a big thing to...
Could it be potentially helpful to her, though?
I think in the end, we all need to lay the past to rest. And part of that is facing it. But it's in baby steps.
Yeah. And one day, of course, Garella will be able to see it too.
Yeah, so she's quite keen to see the bits with her in.
Right, OK. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. That's the self-protection of childhood. Fantastic. Richard Radcliffe, Joseph Fiennes and Philippa Lowthorpe as well. Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is 3 minutes to nine. Just a few minutes to reflect on what has been a sadly quite familiar horror story in Australia for the first day of the Ashes.
All out. Oh, England all out. Not with a bang, baby, with a big whimper. That is terrible.
Oh, yeah, commentator Jim Maxwell milking it there as England collapsed from 105 for four at lunch to 172 all out, but England are fighting back.
Cass goes in and bowls to Smith. Smith is caught at second slip. England have done it again. Brydon Cass with his first Ashes wicket. Cass bowls. Oh, that flies through. There's a peel for a catch behind. He's out. Cass has got another one. Kawaja's on his way. He's gloved that through to Jamie Smith.
Let's check back in with Mike All-Nighter Williams, who I think is just about still awake, are you?
Just about, Anna, yeah.
Just about. I mean, it was a slow response time there, Mike.
the equivalent for the news version of this for all of us on the Today programme is staying up, you know, for a general election or something. From the sporting point of view, the first day of an Ashes Test Down Under has to be what it is.
Have you got one eye on the telly? Because apparently there's another wicket, even as we're speaking.
There has been another wicket, yes. Travis Head falling victim to Ben Stokes, who's actually just bought himself on the captain, looking to get amongst the fray. And he struck very early on. So Travis Head, who was making some inroads for Australia, has gone. Fallen victim to Ben Stokes. So Jofra Archer's got two. Cass has got two. Stokes now with another one. Australia five down, 76 for five. Still trailing England, who, if you missed it, were all out earlier for 172. Australia still trailing by 96 runs. The aim, of course, for England from this position now, which was frankly unthinkable when they were bowled out for 172 earlier, is can they get a first innings lead, which could well be on the cards. As we say, Australia still trailing by 96 runs with five wickets down. And you have to say, England's bowling has been sublime. We talked a lot, didn't we, in the build-up about their pace attack. Archer and Cass, as we say, with a couple. Now Ben Stokes wading in. Mark Wood has been sublime as well. Gus Atkinson. It's been great. So it's this, as we said earlier, you cannot take your eyes off.